Longer, it's 7 minutes beyond the time, so shall we start? The first, just to explain the two other committees, Trade and Industry will be here at 10 o'clock. In the case of Minerals and Minerals Resources, for some bizarre reason, they confused March and February, which is something that's quite beyond me. They thought this meeting was going to be held in February, therefore they couldn't come. But as pointed out in the SMS, it's very clear, it says M-A-R, it can't be confused with A-V-B. They accepted that it was a mistake on their part, but they conveyed their good wishes. So Mineral Resources will not be here, but as I know, they're fully supportive of our meeting because obviously illicit financial flows is greatly impacted on through the minerals economy. In fact, the main culprits, as we all know, in most developing societies is the mineral sector of the economy. So, you know, they need to be a trading industry. Joan explained that she's got something else going, but she'll be here at 10 o'clock. Okay, so shall we get going? Welcome, everybody. The AIDC, as you know, we told you last year, I had a conference at which Mr. Shivambu and I also spoke in a panel, and we said we would invite them. Obviously, in 15 minutes, they're not going to be able to give us a comprehensive overview, but the idea is to at least convey some of the key points and engage with them. And then the main target that, again, like yesterday with Steinhoff, we really want to know what is everybody doing. In particular, what is the hawks, what are the hawks, what are the NPA doing? Because at the end of the day, we can have all these wonderful workshops, Mr. Dominic, but the fact of the matter is that unless we get results, they become like a talk show. But they had a very good conference, very successful. A lot of speakers from mostly our country, but also people from elsewhere in the world. Over to you, Dominic, and your colleague here. You've got 15 minutes, right? I'll time it. Never mind that we're about 8 minutes late. You'll get your full half an hour. Thank you. And so will everybody who needs it. They'll get their full time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Can I just make an observation, a sad observation? I don't know if people have heard, but the chief whip of the majority party, Jackson Mthembu, lost his daughter very sadly this morning. He's very distraught, as you can imagine. She's only 25, and he has already announced it, so the way she died, so there's nothing for me to hide. He's made it public. She committed suicide, unfortunately, which is traumatic for her parents. So can we stand up and observe a moment's silence? Thank you very much. Apart from everything else, he's actually a very wonderful person from my point of view. I have had the privilege of working with five chief whips in five different periods since 1997. And really, he's been an outstanding, I think. I mean, I can't speak for the opposition, obviously. But, you know, from the side of an ANC chairperson, and was probably one of the most experienced chairpersons here, I can tell you, been very, very good as a whip, as a chief whip, supporting the whips in the ANC. A lot of his work is internal to the ANC, obviously. Therefore, other parties won't see the quality of his leadership and his style. And he's a very humane person as well, actually. He's a remarkably nice person, really, with a wonderful sense of humor, and very empathetic, and stands with the committee, the study group chairs, when the executive sometimes tries to, you know, take on the chairs. It's a bit difficult in this committee, of course, with people like Tandi and me around. I'm speaking more of other study groups, and he's been great. Somebody who, for the ANC, I'm speaking of the ANC person, obviously, now, and I make no apology for that. I mean, wouldn't be here in the first instance if I was an ANC. So I speak as an ANC person, which is something that is my primary title, though I play a particular role until the 7th of March. 7th of May, sorry. So I'm just saying that I'm speaking as an ANC person. The insights people who are not in the ANC won't have all him, and he's quite the one of the most remarkable chief whips we've had. Having said that, over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, colleagues. I'm Dominic Brown, the Economic Justice Program Coordinator at the Alternative Information and Development Center. As the Chair said, we only have 15 minutes, and given the brief amount of time, we won't get into much detail, but nonetheless, we are very grateful for the opportunity to present on our work on illicit financial flows, base erosion, and profit shifting, given the importance of this work. But we will also appreciate the possibility of giving a more in-depth briefing in the future. For the purposes of today, I will refer to illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting as IFF and BEPS, or profit shifting for shorthand. I will not define what these include, given parliamentary monitoring group reports indicated this has been covered extensively before in forums like this. Furthermore, I will not be using visuals for this presentation, but we have brought a resource pack that I can see in front there that has a few of our materials that we have produced over the past few years. In the presentation...
Beauty, have you passed it around? That's the stuff you passed around. Thanks so much.
That is. So, today we will be covering a brief context and a framing for the discussion, and then talk to AIDC's entry point and methodology vis-a-vis the work we do on IFF and BEPS before speaking to the outcomes of the high-level seminar which the Chair has alluded to, which AIDC hosted in October last year on ways to combat illicit financial flows and BEPS. So by brief introduction, I think we can all agree that illicit financial flows is a major problem, in that it does not only deprive the state of much-needed financial resources, but it also forces the state to be overly dependent on attracting foreign capital and or borrowing. Furthermore, profit shifting deprives minority shareholders of their fair share in dividends and exposes local businesses to unfair competition. Moreover, the state is under increasing pressure to do more, more spending on healthcare, education, housing, and so on, but with limited and declining resources to do so. So in the context of a growing debt burden, increasing budget deficit, stagnant economic growth, and the desperate need to increase the tax base, tackling IFF and BEPS is critical. Now, unlike initiatives that attempt to give an estimate of the aggregate scale of IFF and BEPS, such as some academics in South Africa, the Global Financial Integrity, or the African Union High-Level Panel on Illicit Financial Flows from Africa, for example, AIDC has undertaken concrete case studies to get the sense of exactly how these transnational corporations operate. So over the years, we've done a number of case studies, including into Lonmin following the outcomes of the Falun Commission inquiry after the Marikana massacre, Total Coal South Africa, Barplats, and Robertson Winery, and these all give a sense of the transfer pricing, profit shifting, thin capitalization. These practices are in fact embedded in transnational corporations, and it's not an aberration that you'll find in one or two of such corporations. Most recently, we've just completed another investigation into another mining company who we have discovered to be involved in transfer pricing arrangements. For example, a payment of 9% sales commission fees, as well as fraud. Now, in previous reports, I've seen these committees and statutory bodies here have said that it's important that we take these corporations to court, and we fully agree. Therefore, we are in the process of putting together a case against the aforementioned corporation. However, currently the name is confidential, but litigation should start in June or July this year, which will allow us to go public with the information. So in the words of our president, watch this space. So in October last year, AIDC hosted this high-level seminar on IFF and BEPS. And the seminar, as the chair pointed out, was attended by a number of important stakeholders, including XR's officials, the former head of the Large Business Center, some parliamentarians, including the chair of the Standing Committee on Finance, international experts, NGOs, and journalists, etc. And one of the main outcomes of the seminar was the launching of the Stop the Bleeding campaign. And this is a metaphor for the gushing of capital that we're experiencing from South Africa on an annual basis, and a means to put an end to it. And the Stop the Bleeding campaign is a platform that brings together different organizations and people already working on tackling issues of IFF and BEPS in order to develop a more coherent strategy to put an end to profit shifting from South Africa. We also hope that this initiative will help to ensure that the issue of profit shifting remains central to the debate, to the political debate in the country. But there were also concrete proposals that came out of the seminar, such as the restoration of the institutional capacity of the state, including SARS and other institutions. Now, we have noted that work on this has already been done, increasing the personnel at SARS, increasing resources, restoring the capacity of the MPA, and so on. And we commend the commitment of the committees that meet here, including the DMR, Treasury, SARS, Reserve Bank, the Financial Intelligence Center, and so on, to fighting combat IFFs and BEFs, but also a commitment to collaborate in doing so. We feel that these are critical steps. However, we think that it's not enough. And this is because state capture, in our opinion, only partly explains the declining revenue collections and parallel levels of profit shifting from South Africa annually. And that is because illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting has been a problem before the state capture saga. So therefore, beyond restoring the capacity of state institutions, the seminar underscored the importance of increasing the state capacity through legal mechanisms in order to more adequately tackle tax evasion by transnational corporations and certain individuals. So to this end, we've argued to move towards the legislation of a general anti-tax avoidance or GATA Act, which will allow SARS to prosecute parties implicated in tax evasion. And we think this can go a long way in supporting the endeavors to put an end to profit shifting. There were also additional immediate policy reforms to curb IFF and BEPS in relation to enhanced transparency. Enhanced transparency must become the new normal at all levels of the economy and the government, from asset ownership to companies' tax policies. The disclosure of decision makers' tax returns will also be critical. So the government's minimum commitment in the immediate future must be to the ABCs. What I mean by this is, A, we need an automatic exchange of information. This is already in place in certain jurisdictions. However, it's not in place in all. And South Africa has a role to play in to push for reforms to ensure that the current system is not a dating game, where effectively, if we don't have sufficient technical capacities or rich countries with so-called privacy concerns refuse to share the information with you, and in other words, you don't get picked. B, we need to have beneficial ownership disclosure in public registries. This will go a long way towards boosting revenues from personal income tax collection, particularly in relation to high net worth individuals. It will also ensure that it won't be possible to conceal transactions between the related entities and will furthermore limit illicit financial flows linked to the disposal of assets. C, country by country and subsidiary by subsidiary, public reporting by transnational corporations. Reporting obligations, in fact, already exists for companies. However, it's not made public information. Now, ensuring that this information is made public is essential for oversight and accountability. For example, for civil society organizations to play an active role in holding corporations and corrupt individuals to account will necessitate that they, or we in this instance, have access to this information. Finally, D, disclosure of tax returns of every South African elected representative for the general public to see the commitment of MPs to dealing with the problem. All of these proposals, or the idea behind all of these proposals rather, is to ensure that everyone's tax obligations is congruent with real economic activity. Now, for practical purposes, we also recommend that South Africa pays special attention to two main industries: mining, partly for the reasons already mentioned by the chair, and the digital economy. So mining has historically been a major source of illicit financial flows from South Africa and still represents a very big component of our exports. And in terms of mining, it's important that we make certain types of transactions to ensure that certain types of transactions are not used to deplete the profits of local subsidiaries and therefore South Africa's tax base. For example, through the payment of consultation fees, insurance fees, interest repayments on debts, and sales commission fees, or in other words, transfer pricing and thin capitalization, two of the main instruments used by TNCs to shift profits directed towards jurisdictions with low or no statutory tax requirements, i.e. tax havens. This needs to be clamped down. Secondly, there should be a creation of a national state selling agency to undertake the export of minerals at market prices. This has three core advantages. Firstly, there will be no more sales commission fees. Secondly, no more trade misinvoicing. And thirdly, a higher level of sovereignty of our national mineral resources. In relation to the digital economy, there are two reasons for focusing on this. Firstly, its rapid growth is likely to become a major source of illicit financial flows going forward. And this raises the potential to be able to retrieve huge amounts of resources in what is becoming a rapidly growing sector. And secondly, there's a window of opportunity internationally that is being opened up by the European Union's focus on the tax obligations of tech giants, such as Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, commonly known as the GAFAs. So, in conclusion, there are three points I would like to make. First, A, there are three main priorities beyond rebuilding SARS. The need to implement the Garta Act, the legislation that will reduce the space for profit shifting in this regard, is critical. Two, we need enhanced transparency as a tool for compliance in the short term, but in the longer term, towards a move towards a unitary tax system, which will ensure that countries are not pitted against each other, moving towards the corporate tax race to the bottom, which we've already seen most recently with the U.S. reducing a statutory corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, and the role of profit shifting is instrumental in this process. Thirdly, in relation to moving beyond rebuilding SARS and other state institutions, we feel that special attention must be paid to strategic sectors such as mining and the digital economy. Secondly, in relation to the case and the litigation that we're taking up, we would be very happy to do a briefing with the colleagues in the room as soon as it's made public. We think that this will be instrumental. We've noted that previously 23 cases were brought up and no prosecutions came out of this. This will be an important step, and we are quite a modest NGO with limited capacities, so we can only imagine the possibilities if the political will is there to take this forward within this institutions that are here today. Thirdly, in the resource pack that provided, there are the few resources that we provided here, but we're also in the process of publishing a document which we provided to Alan for those who are interested on the state of tax evasion in South Africa, which is an extensive study on where things are at, particularly within relation to the international dimension within which we are faced. We will also be happy to circulate this electronically for those who are interested on request. So that's just a brief input on where we think we can go in the immediate term, but there are also much longer term ideas that we have in tackling this scourge that's facing our country and many other countries in the world today. So we thank you for the opportunity and we look forward to future engagement.
We're exactly 15 minutes and about 30 seconds. Very good. Right, questions please? Comments? Peggy?
Thank you, comrade. Good morning to you all. Chair, we are actually delighted to learn that state institutions are taking this matter seriously because it has been happening, you know, for quite a long time. I was actually asking myself a question that says, I wonder how much of illicit financial flow happened before the dawn of this democracy, and whether the this organization, Alternative Information and Development Center, has ever worried about it or have ever investigated whether it happened and how much had it happened before the dawn of democracy. Indeed, it is a matter that needs to be dealt with. My question is, why is it happening? Is it because maybe these transnational companies or corporations do not really believe that South Africa also need to grow, you know? Or is it because of greed? They just want to maximize their profits and that's it. And secondly, I'm worried about the capacity of the hawks and other state enforcement institutions, whether they will have capacity to deal with matters around digital economy in particular, and of course mining economy. What should happen? Should we start by maybe focusing on capacitating these state institutions so that they may be able to deal with such matters? The third one is around the declaration by public representatives. Do you believe that some of us as public representatives might be involved in the IFF or what? Thank you.
Sorry, it's not really that I had nothing to say. I didn't raise my hand earlier. I'm a bit bewildered by this presentation because, firstly, I'm not exactly sure where it fits in the. What we have here is like some kind of ideological treatise on the nature of decolonization and Bermuda's history, and so I'm not even sure whether we're really supposed to engage with that, because as you can imagine, I of course disagree with a great deal of what is said here. But if we're just meant to focus on some of the solutions, which, unless I haven't looked properly, unfortunately, you mentioned, I think, in your presentation, but aren't in the handout. But two of the ones which I did pick up on, I mean, is that, firstly, I think there's been many forums, where these issues have been raised, be it the Davis Tax Commission and other such areas. So, you know, I'm cautious when it sometimes seems like we're just starting from scratch again and rehashing the conversation. Each conversation we have kind of needs to pick up a little bit from where the previous discussions left off. Otherwise, we're just having the same repetitive conversation. So I think everyone understands that illicit financial flows are a problem. It is also important, though, to always bear in mind that BEPS is not necessarily in all cases illegal. So when we say that we wish to do something, it must be clear which part of those activities are we wanting to address and why, if they're not illegal per se. I also would just caution being overly gimmicky. So I understand the symbolism that some people might attach to requiring, for example, members of parliament to declare their tax returns. Now, I'm not saying this without recognition of the society we live in and the fact that an MP's salary to the average African will look like a great deal, but speaking as somebody who's come from the private sector, MPs don't really earn that much in the big scheme of things. I'm not quite sure what declaring MP salary serves. It might be symbolic, but then again, symbolic to whom? Trust me, the kind of wealthy individuals or corporations that engage in these practices don't give a hoot what MPs are doing. We aren't an entity that matters at all to them. We're small fry. So I'm not quite sure whether you think they will suddenly take inspiration from MPs and say, oh, well, you know, if this MP is declaring their taxes, I think I'd better do so as well. I mean, I just don't know what that will achieve. I'm not necessarily opposed to it in principle. I just wouldn't bother being engaged in trying to do that or entering that political conversation, because I don't think it really will achieve anything. And then one of the other suggestions raised was that of a unitary tax system. Now, I also find this recommendation deeply problematic. I do think, and again, this is why in some sense the conversation requires to go a bit further back, because obviously I likely have a very different view of how markets should operate and the appropriate role of government regulation within that marketplace. And I do think it is the rightful place for any sovereign nation to determine how it wishes to explore its competitive advantage. And some countries have said that, well, we're going to be provide incentives or a better tax climate for these range of companies or perhaps all businesses. But I think that's really for each country to determine. And I think once you get into a unitary tax system, you'll start to saying, well, why shouldn't we have unitary subsidies, unitary incentives? I mean, there are many reasons why a company or an individual chooses to invest in one country over another. It's not just about taxes. So you're simply just going to shift incentives. If it's not taxes, because suddenly everyone is taxing the same, then people will go to a place that has a better incentive structure. You know, you could have a country that says, do you know what, if you invest here, you won't need to build any infrastructure. We'll take care of all your infrastructure needs. Are you going to start saying, well, every single country must provide the same infrastructure, sort of base, you know, baseline infrastructure, etc.? I just think it's a mad idea that will simply roll over to other areas of incentivizing companies and individuals. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
Now, firstly, for those members who are not here, we're unapologetic about inviting you. It's important. Our main focus today, as it has been in the last three sittings, is on what can be done, as I said in my introductory remarks. It's not about theory, strategy, policy. It's about action, action, action. But every now and then there's a conference that's held, and we have international experts coming too who know about, and South African experts who know about experiences in other countries. Now, I think Dominique's 15 minutes didn't convey the depth, the range, and scope of that two-day conference I attended. I learned a lot. This has become my obsession personally since 2015 or thereabouts. It was Floyd Chivambu who first raised it as a big issue. And to be fair to him, at the time, it wasn't, although the Communist Party has been putting this on the agenda since the 90s, and Peggy, your Central Committee reports have been raising it every now and then, it hadn't hit me with the force that he did when Floyd raised it. And then as we began to find, you know, that we're not raising the revenue we should, and on the other hand, money's flowing out of the country, then this issue became ever more important. So we've been seeking to meet at least twice a year. In our own quarterly reports, every quarter we require National Treasury and SARS to report on what they're doing about IFFs. So each committee has been in its quarterly reports presumably doing its own work. So trade and industry does its work. We do ours. We raised with the police committee. Francois Buchmann's very cooperative. Please do something. Every time the hawks appear before you, or the police do, question them on what they're doing. So it's something each committee does every quarter. We cannot prescribe to other committees, and we've been doing it every quarter, and then twice a year we try to meet as a group. Today it turned out, as it's the last day of Parliament and various people are attending to various personal matters apart from political responsibilities, it turned out to be disappointing in way of multi-party and multi-committees and the number of attendees. But nevertheless, it's very important. So we have no regrets that we called you. And I wish you could summarize in 3 pages or something and send it to us, the key things that came out of your conference. It was a very useful conference, I thought. It gave me more insights. Unlike other people, I like learning and growing. So till the day I drop dead, Dominique, if I bump into you at the Checkers or whatever, you can tell me whatever you want about base erosion and profit shifting. The first thing I want to say is the point Peggy is raising. And you see, I think people must be a bit careful. We're not directing ourselves as individuals here. Actually, you know who's responsible, Twiggy, in my view, for where the NPA and the Hawks are? It's us, as politicians. It is our poor supervision, political supervision, and our undue interference. Ultimately, when the Hawks fail and the NPA fails, it's the portfolio committees in those areas and the related portfolio committees that are accountable. But even within all the constraints the NPA and the Hawks have, our previous experiences with you has been very disappointing. So I think you will see what they have to say. I spoke to the Minister of Justice exactly yesterday, as I said I would, on the Steinhoff matter. I looked for the Minister of Police. He wasn't there, but if he's not in the house today, I will phone him. I have spoken to him 3 times already. He is very empathetic. In fact, you know, there's nothing to hide. Vicky's quite a humble person. He said to me, Eunice, can you give me a bit more stuff on illicit financial flows? And Zakhele, remember you did a one-page summary for me. It was actually for the minister, right? And then I gave him a copy of a speech I gave at some international party. He's very concerned about this thing. So, Dominic, first question.
Yes.
You know what's good? You're taking some company to court. I hope you nail them. I hope you achieve some success. And on behalf of the ANC, I wish you well. Really. I can't speak for the committee. Nail them. We need somebody there. So we wish you well. We don't care where you belong ideologically. We all have a common interest in this thing. If 1 cent is leaving this country wrongly, it's bad enough. And you know what's outrageous? It's by the norms of the free market. If you're a free marketeer, a complete free marketeer, you know you must pay your profits. You must pay your taxes where you make your profit. It's not even a left-wing or a social democratic or even a liberal point of view. It's a straightforward free market policy. Where you make your profits, you must pay your taxes. So the biggest criminals in this country come from the private sector. From what I know, I'm no expert, Dominic, you people are, and others of you here. From what I know, we're the 10th largest loser of money. And it's mining economies, am I right, Dominic, that are particularly vulnerable. Yes, people can focus on the Guptas, rightly so. But quite frankly, they are small fry compared to big capital. Am I right? I want you to respond to that. So, Dominic, continue your good work. I wish there were more NGOs focusing on this. I wish you were out on the streets, marching to Parliament, you know, on the day we have a budget, on the day we have the MTBPS, because we are losing the figure that I see. And we can never tell exactly. If you ask Momo, Momo will tell you by the very nature of this thing, how do you pin down a figure? But for what it's worth, Global Financial Integrity says, Peggy, that from 2002 to 2012, maybe it's exaggerated, right? I don't know. NT people tell me, South people say it's an exaggerated figure. I don't care, really, Peggy. What difference does it make whether it's $122 billion that disappeared or whether it was 121.0.9510 cents? Does it really matter? 122 billion. Even if it's 1/4 of that, it's outrageous. Right? That was then. Now I hear somewhere else that at least 50 billion rands a year disappears. What are your figures? By its very nature, you can't pin this down because of this is done mainly by big capital in this country, right? Who will focus on corruption in the public sector, but you know, like Steinhoff yesterday, they get away scot-free. So, keep up your good work. Respond to the questions, please, and the comments.
Thank you, Chair. So, first of all, in relation to illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting, yes, we have reason to believe that it has predated the transition. it's not a problem unique to South Africa. It's a global problem. The problem is that being able to access the information for most of these periods is very difficult. But we can say conclusively that we see a growing trend in a growing number of illicit financial flows leaving South Africa over the past 3 decades. So yes, it probably started or did start before 1994, but as around the world you'll see that the level or the scale of it has increased dramatically. Why is it happening? I think you nailed it on the head when you mentioned greed. This is about not even corporations in itself doesn't actually benefit completely. It's one or two individuals, while other shareholders often suffer or don't get the full extent of their dividends. I don't think this is an ideological thing. I think it's a common sense thing. We're seeing everywhere, even in the UK, the need to clamp down on these issues. Even in the US, there's calls to do this. So it's not ideological. It's what is needed at the moment to ensure that people can live decent human lives. And it cannot happen unless we hold people to account. So if you want accountability, then we have to ensure that we clamp down on illicit financial flows as a matter of urgency. Now, Gwen mentioned that it's not illegal, but then she adds the word per se. Now, I don't think you will have to substantiate that if you think the problem, if you don't think it's a problem. It might not be illegal, but it's definitely immoral. And regardless of the blurred lines between what's illegal and what's legal, I think we need to put in the measures to ensure that these practices are not allowed to continue. Now, of course, it's difficult, or a bit more difficult, when it's not illegal per se. However, we can, for the very start, ensure that the illegal activities are put to an end, and then start to reduce the space for corporations to embark on these practices, transfer pricing arrangements, thin capitalization, etc., in the long term. Now, yes, there are many initiatives. The Davis Tax Committee was one. But this presentation actually moves beyond the Davis Tax Committee. We engaged it. We were part of the process. And this is the next steps, exactly what the chair is saying. What can be done? What are the immediate reforms? What are the long-term ones? What's the low-hanging fruit? Let's get down to the business, to the nitty-gritty of doing these things, rather than chasing our tails trying to determine what's legal and what's illegal. This is a matter of urgency. Let's do what needs to be done to tackle it. Yes, public officials may be small fry. You may say that parliamentarian salary is small fry. I mean, in South Africa, I will say that's very debatable given the level of unemployment. I mean, if you think that 80% of the population fall under minimum wage, then MP salary is a king's salary in a South African context. So I think we must be clear about what we're talking about and understand where we are located. Once again, this is not ideological. It's common sense. Now, just in terms of the comments made by the chair, thank you for your support. I think it's important that civil society and the state, through these various institutions, can work more closely together in tackling these issues that are fundamental for the perpetuation of the democracy founded in 1994 and for the continuation or the realization of the socio-economic rights imprinted in the constitution of the country. If we don't agree with that, then I think we need to go back to the drawing board and think about what it is we want to do. Yes, the mining sector is largely responsible. And yes, South Africa is, given the size of our GDP, one of the biggest emitters of illicit financial flows, base erosion and profit shifting in the world. Some reports say 10th, more recent ones say even as high as 7th. This is terrible news for a country that urgently needs a greater amount of resources, not just to cover our debt, never mind, which everyone agrees upon, never mind other more social and human rights expenditure. In terms of the scale itself, yes, there are many different amounts that come in, and the reason why is because it's so difficult to actually get a true sense of what's going on. And this is because of the opaque nature with which these transnational corporations operate. To be able to determine exactly how much, I think it would be very difficult. However, the point you make about 120 billion, that's one estimate. Another one says approximately between 4 and 10% of South Africa's GDP per annum. These are huge amounts of money that's leaving our country. AIDC doesn't focus on these aggregate demands for the exact reasons we've just pointed out. And this is why we want to look at exact corporations who we figure are involved in these practices to give more light into exactly how these corporations operate. And when we do so, if we agree, first of all, that this is not just one or two corporations, but in fact in the DNA of transnational corporations, and we've been able to pinpoint at least five who have been shifting profits in the range of 200, at least one corporation between 500 million rand a year for over a five-year period, and that is probably the tip of the iceberg, then we can only imagine the amount. Now, you make the point, Chair, that even if it's 1 cent leaving the shores illegally, we need to clamp down on it. So I think the scale is huge, but having the exact amount is inconsequential to the problem. The real consequence is that we are aware that this is a problem facing the country. The range of the problem can be debated, but the fact that the problem is there is undeniable. These, what we've suggested today, are some of the concrete steps that can be taken, and that it's not far-fetched or idealistic or ideological, but rather sensical, must be done steps, and South Africa is in a position to be a global game changer. This can, like we did in 1994 and the ending of apartheid, show the world once again that that South Africa has a moral high ground from which we stand, and that we should be setting the rules of the game for the rest of the world to follow. This is an opportunity for us once again to show the citizens of South Africa that there's hope in a country that we all fought for. So I hope that covers the questions.
Yeah, no, I understand, right. John Fabs, you might know, well, who doesn't, chairs the Trade and Industry Committee. Look, can I ask you a question about the law? Do you think that at the moment, our committee feels that it's largely a matter of enforcement, right? It's largely a matter of lack of necessary skills. But that the legislation for now is okay, it's implementing it, that's the challenge. Do you think there is a lacuna, what vacuum in the legislation, and if so, in what sense? Any other questions? We need to round up because the next lot comes in. In what sense do you see? Secondly, we've discussed this before in our committee, right? We've said, yes, there's what you call tax avoidance, which is legal, and tax evasion, which is illegal. For us, morally, there's no justification for that distinction. I mean, practically, obviously, the law enforcement agencies can't act against tax avoidance. Then Shivambu said to us, well, why don't we invite PwC and Deloitte and so on, these paragons of capitalist virtue, I think is what he meant. I'm extrapolating from what he said. Those are my words, not his, to be fair to him. Now, the thing is, we think in our exit report, Zakele, we can slide in a question, where's Zakele? He's disappeared, right? Alan, can you remember? I have some latitude to slide in that a decision they taken was to invite all of these people to ask them, what is it they do and why do they do it? It's something we took a decision on and we forgot to put in. So, in just one sentence, that when in our exit report, we made illicit financial flows a big issue. But we have to guide the committee and come see in on some of the things not guide them. We can only offer them advice. They're not obliged to listen to anything we say. But an exit report, we suggest to them, they look at IFS, but one of the things they should do is something we said we would do, and we didn't get around to doing it because of time and other constraints, which is invite all these big companies and just see what it is they do and how they justify it to themselves. I mean, is it not reprehensible, after all, that it's the PwCs, the Deloittes, and so on of this world that assist these people to avoid paying taxes in the country where they make their profits? And, you know, it's outrageous. Isn't it Google and Amazon and all of these people that are the key? It's a global problem, as you say, Dominique. It's Google, Amazon, who else? Nike, is it? Who else? And Microsoft, who are the key?
Apple, Facebook, and Amazon.
Now look at that. Look at the super profits they make. And you know, there is a emerging international parliamentary, the parliamentary network on the World Bank has it, because of South Africa, on its agenda each time. But there is also a broader structure that's looking at what MPs can do globally to stem the tide of illicit financial flows. So if there aren't any more questions, we can respond to these. We need to move on. Thank you.
Thanks again, Chair. I would speak to the question of enforcement, and then my colleague just wants to say a little bit about tax evasion and tax avoidance and the distinctions between the two. So I hear you, Chair, saying enforcement's the problem. There's no legislative lacuna at all. So I would say, Chair, then why haven't we seen any prosecutions before the state capture saga? Why haven't we seen this problem being nailed down before? I think, yes, we have to improve the capacity for enforcement. But as we pointed out, it's just not enough. There are loopholes in the legislation. The legislation exists, yes. We don't deny it, we've seen it, but it's important that we're able to strengthen it in ways that ensures it's watertight. That the minute SAR sees that there's discrepancies beyond a certain threshold, which we think is currently too high, or when DTI sees weights, we need to audit this trade that's taking place right now, and we see these discrepancies, then where does that go? We think that implementing an act that ensures that all of these things can go to immediate prosecution will go a long way in closing the space for profit shifting to take place in the first place. So it's beyond combating. It's also, or after the fact, it's also it's a preventative measure to deter these practices from happening in the first instance. So it's a dual approach that's required by, or that will be the outcome of strengthening the legislation.
Two or three examples of where it's unfair to you, consider it in writing. Two or three examples of what you think should be put in the law.
Chair, unfortunately, I'm not a legal expert. I can't answer that.
There should be some legal amendment that provides for immediate prosecution. That's going to be a tough one, let me tell you, because that falls under justice, eh? And you'll have to find criteria for that. I don't know if any other country has that. We had special prosecution courts during the World Cup, so the legislative framework for that sort of thing is there. But you must imagine, yeah, there'll be a vigorous fight back from the private sector. So I think you need to think through more carefully, you know, what it is. Remember, we remain as members of parliament till the 7th of May, and the committee chairs continue to function. So you write to us, we send through Alan Wickham and Tebow Sepanya the stuff you give us. Within 7 days, tell us three or four legislative, precise legislative, doable ones that you think can be done, and we will forward it to the incoming committee.
Thanks, Shay. If I may, just a question. Perhaps I'm completely left of field here, but is it not possible for a bill to be passed through a parliamentary process through the adoption and pushing of a private member's bill? Is this not a way, at least, to move towards enforcing greater legislation?
Oh, that's allowed in terms of the Constitution. And you can bring a bill as a member. I don't know, in the new parliament who would sponsor that, but the rule allows it. In fact, they had a committee bill. You can have a private member's bill, which comes from an individual MP from whichever party. It could be an ANC MP as well. But you also have what you call committee bills. Now, there's also presumably the executive that could also bring a bill, you know, based on their feeling that, look, there may be some vacuum they want to fill. In any case, they do, when they bring the tax bills, they do every now and then tighten the loopholes. But each time this happens, PwC and Deloitte and all of them are two steps ahead, right? So they do regularly amend, and Momo will speak to that to the end, at the end when he speaks. But very quickly, time's running out. You want to say something? Yes.
Yeah, quickly on the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion. I think it's important to remind ourselves that in many cases, what is considered as tax avoidance should be considered as tax evasion. However, it's not possible to do so simply because the tax rules based on the arm's length principle are too complex. And so that means that tech giant, for example, because that's the biggest, like, and more obvious example, Google, Apple, those companies, it is so easy for them to play around legislation, to misalign, to play around accounting treatment, to make sure that the tax obligation doesn't reflect the effective economic substance. And so, de facto, because the tax book doesn't reflect this economic substance, it should be considered as tax evasion. However, so far, the tax rules, the international tax system is so complex because it is built on the arm's length principle, meaning that each and every transaction of a single local entity has to be inquired to see if the price of this transaction is the right one. It is almost impossible for tax authorities to clamp them down and to prosecute those companies. But de facto, that we should consider that this is tax evasion because it doesn't reflect the economic substance of this company. And that's why the unitary tax system is particularly important, because instead of considering companies are a bunch of single entity in each and every country they're operating, they'll consider multinational company as one single worldwide entity and will apportion afterwards their profit to specific countries and allow these countries to tax at the rate they want. So you keep your tax freedom at the rate they want, the portion that is apportioned to this country. So that's moving towards more simplicity that would make possible the prosecution of non-compliant companies. Thank you, Chair.
The argument that, fine, we're a developing country, let's say, and we need investment, and we know that money will go out. There are companies that bring in the investment will also take out some of their profits and hide them through basic erosion on profit shifting, which could be legal, or even tax evasion. But since we are poor developing countries, let's say elsewhere on this continent or the developing world, we know IFF takes place, but we also need investment. So we balance out the need for investment with the prospect that the companies that bring the money in terms of investment will also take a significant part of it out through illicit financial flows and not pay the profits, not pay the taxes on the profits they make in our country. So you balance it out. It's not as if governments are blind to it. They are vulnerable because their companies will say, I'm not going to invest in this country because its IFF legislation is so tough that I'll end up in jail. So I'd rather go to the country next door. What's your response to that?
Thank you, Chair. Very important question. First of all, this argument is often used as a scarecrow to deter you from implementing stricter or policies that will help to regulate corporations. That's the first point. Secondly, what we'll see is that empirically, countries that have already started embarking on tightening the game or the rules of the game for corporations to operate in, there has actually been no massive exodus of investment. That it's empirically proven. This is not a thumbs up. And finally, if we don't do this, ultimately in the long run, we are all losers, because what we are seeing is a global tax race to the bottom, where ultimately states will actually have no capacity to function at all. So it's important in the long run even that these legislations are implemented. So if we don't do it, the exact things that you're saying now will in fact happen, rather than if you actually do it.
Okay.
Well, Joan will chair the second latter half of the meeting. I'll chair until the FIC. So, Saps and Hawks, Your Honor. Thank you very much, AIDC. Where's the Hawks, General? Over to you. You've got a submission from them. Yeah. Okay. Where's your members?
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Today I'm accompanied by the Deputy, Lieutenant General Matakata, the component head of a serious commercial crime, Major General Kana, and the Administrator, Colonel Davenport, in the space of serious commercial crime. As a matter of introduction, I just want to indicate, because this question of capacitation of the DPC, I know it always comes. Just to indicate that in other forums where we have made a fuller brief, we have indicated the capacity where we are and where we are supposed to be. We are actually half of what we are supposed to be. That is when it speaks to human resource. As I indicated, we normally work in teams. You shall have noted at the beginning of this month, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, that in Mpumalanga there was this sensitive case where we have spent more than 4 months investigating what we have discovered to be a lie, but that I was focused on very senior officials, which we wasted a lot of resources to come and uncover that this is actually a lie. And there was underlining that investigation no less than 700,000 that was deposited, which we still want to know precisely what was the motive for this. Last night, we had put a team again of the Hawks in the Northwest because on the 13th, there was a report of cash in transit robbery where the money was taken. We have been investigating this in a form of team, taking away the resources to work on this. Last night we arrested three, and then we recovered half of the loot. But disappointingly, the people that we have arrested are precisely the one who said they have been robbed. And the loot that we have recovered is precisely with them. We expect that we might be recovering the remaining loot because we think it's not all that we have arrested. But this is just part of some of the reports that come forward, which actually deprive the focus where we are supposed to be focusing. We have to do it, because if you don't do it, it will remain cash in transit robbery where the people have taken the money home. Chairperson and Honorable Members, coming to the presentation, the purpose of this is to apprise the members of the committee on the work done by the DPCI in partnership with the Inter-Agency Working Group on Illicit Financial Flows. The background is that IFF, subsequent to the parliamentary hearing in 2017 relating to the illicit financial flows, the Financial Intelligence Center called on a meeting of the various government agencies to create a coordinating forum, the IFFs. During 2018, a terms of reference for the coordinating forum was drafted and approved, resulting in the inter-agency group of IFS. two levels of IFS coordination have been created through the TOR, namely Operational Inter-Agency Working Group and the Task Working Group. The Operational Committee is responsible for the overall coordination and direction of the IFS matters, while the Task Working Group is responsible for the receipt and selection of cases requiring a multi-agency, multidisciplinary approach. In addition to the 8 selected cases, of which the high-level cooperation between all agencies, feedback will be given on this by the FIC. The DPCI deals with all cases reported under the umbrella of illicit financial flows. The DPCI has dedicated members that deal with the illicit financial flow cases. Following is just a slide showing a summary of some of the matters that we are dealing with as of March 2019. In the first block, it shows that the matters that have been finalized in court. We have got those 12 matters where 21 accused persons were found guilty. I will slightly touch on the details, but the NPA may deal more with the matters. There are also 15 matters that are on the court roll as we speak. Others are matters that the warrant of arrest have been issued, and 9 of these cases there was a declination of prosecution, so the matters were withdrawn based on insufficient grounds to secure any possibility of securing a conviction. There were also 3 inquiries that were finalized, and as we speak, there are 36 matters that are under investigation. That is a summary of what we are currently having as on March. I need now to highlight on some of the investigation from the 8 cases, which I will not deal in detail, as I have already indicated that the FIC will deal with these matters. In a current case pending matter, where an amount of 17 million was seized, an investigation is being conducted into the QSG Ponzi scheme that was managed from South Africa, and the funds were transferred to Dubai and have been traced to the UK as well. The funds in the UK are currently preserved under an order, approximately 5 million euros. The funds in Dubai is approximately 5 million US dollars, and the process are to be started. There are 450 investors that have been identified in this matter. All are South Africans, and 41 statements have already been obtained. 30 witnesses have been lined up in arrangement with the prosecution authority, that it may not necessarily be every single statement that may be necessary. The audit report has been finalized and has been made available to the team. 3 suspects, of which 2 have warrants of arrest, have not yet been arrested. We are working on those. A suspect operated various companies and purported to be importing goods. The suspect offered a Reserve Bank official 20 million rands not to pursue the matter. She was arrested and convicted of corruption and is currently serving 10 years imprisonment. The exchange control regulations cases will be placed on the roll in the near future, where an amount of 15 billion rand is involved. Some highlights on the convictions that I have pointed out is that 9 convictions were secured relating to physical export of cash through the ports of entry, where an amount of approximately 137 1.5 million was forfeited to the state. I have listed the case numbers as well as the name of those who have been convicted and the nature of the sentences that have been meted out. I'll not read each individual line, but the presentation has been provided that reflects that information. In the next slide, it also continues to show the breakdown of this 1.37 million rand, but it's a repetition of what has been said. This one is just a breakdown. Continuing with the highlights on the Durban North matter, where 12 accused were convicted in terms of the exchange control regulations. There has been sentences, of which the sentences are fines of 5,000 rand or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 6 months. And this is obviously suspended, and an additional 5 years, which is suspended for 5 years. A total amount of 16 million rand is involved in all those cases that I have mentioned. In Komatipoort this year, this month, two accused were found guilty of illegal exchanging currency at the border post, and they have been sentenced to 4 months imprisonment, suspended for 5 years. Obviously, the sentences themselves will always show that it's not that great, but is the nature of the crime that we are dealing with. Continuing with some of the highlights on some investigation, the cases that are currently on the roll, I'm just reflecting those that are on the roll, and I also mentioned the name of the accused, because in this matter they have already been charged. We can mention their names. It speaks on the case where it resort, as well as the name of the accused, and just a little bit detail of the background, and then we also show the amount that is being involved in this current cases that are on the roll. The next slide again continues to deal with those matters that are on the court roll. It again reflects the places where this have happened, the names of the accused, the summary, and the amount that is involved, both in the rents, the US dollars, as well as the euros. With regards to the cases currently on the court roll, because they have been charged, we just also indicated the names of the accused as well as the amount that are being involved in each of these cases. That, in short, Honorable Chairperson and members, is the current status of the investigation that we are dealing with other role players. This is only those that are handled by the DPCI, is not the whole SAPS. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members.
Okay, then we have the NPA.
Apologize on behalf of the NDPP. She could not. Yeah, she has already advised you of the fact that she's engaged in respect of other activities, yes.
And then Chairman, also... Sorry, where is the person who's missing? Why are they not here?
No. Remember, I told you I did speak to Ms. Batoy, and I asked her if she could attend preferably this one rather than yesterday's. And she explained that she certainly can't make yesterday, and that she'll try to make it for this one, but she thinks it's unlikely. We asked for her to be here, but she said that she's finding her feet, as it were, and she's got too much on her plate. Previously, we haven't asked for the NDPP to be here, and as Sean Abrahamson appear here, it's always been. But now, because it's the end of our term and we wanted to communicate just how important illicit financial flows is and the need for tackling it, we wanted her to be here. But she did give us, I did explain all that, but I can speak to you offline if you want. But what I also had intended, I was going to confer with you, Comrade John, and others, but there just wasn't time, is to call the ministers here. And I think that's something else we need to do. It's time now we call the ministers here. Because we've been calling for an interministerial committee. And every time when you speak to the minister who was there at the time, he is never a she, says, no, you're right. I have, two of them have raised it with the president, the previous president, and said, yeah, he didn't say yes, he didn't say no, he said, okay, you know, we'll think about it. So I think that's something we should also slide into our exit report, Alan. Zakele, you're back, eh? There were two points we made. That, remember, we took a decision on PwC, etc., inviting them here on their role in illicit financial flows. Mm-hmm. We should slide it in. And then the second one is this thing about calling in the ministers in future. At least once a year, possibly twice a year, they must come and answer directly. Okay, having said that, over to you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Chair, and I'm with Advocate Molele, Acting Special Director in the AFU. He will deal with the involvement of the AFU in respect of cases that are presently addressed by the government agency group. And then I'm aware of the fact that General Levia has already made a presentation on some of the cases that are on the court roll, and I think maybe it is due to some miscommunication or lack of coordination of information, because some of them, from the information, our information is the MPA, though it has been reflected as cases that are on the court roll, some of them have already been finalized.
Oh.
And therefore we'll try to ensure that we have got information that talk to each other. And furthermore, I want to indicate to the committee that due to time constraints, some of the information on cases that are finalized is incomplete. I only got updated information this morning from the Durban office. And then furthermore, in respect of cases that have been, that are on the court roll, as well as cases that are finalized, the most unfortunate part is that we omitted somehow, somewhere, because the SECU is the unit that is involved in coordination of even the IFFS matters, to include the organized crime, because there must be cases from the organized crime space that are presently on the court roll, as well as being finalized. We'll ensure that the information is updated and we've got a complete picture of how the law enforcement agencies are addressing this phenomenon.
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, can I please ask where you can not to use abbreviations? Sorry, just some of us aren't familiar with all the NPA-related...
Okay, no, it's fine. It's the illicit financial flows. Thank you. And therefore, the NPA is part of the government agencies, which forms part of the coordinating forum on illicit financial flows, which is spearheaded by the FIC. And therefore, the activities of the agency have been dealt with by the DPCI in the presentation. And for the purpose of this presentation to the committee, I'll deal with the following. Cases involving the illicit financial flows finalized by the MPA, that is in addition to what has been presented by General Levia, as well as cases that are on the court roll, as well as collaboration between the MPA and other stakeholders in the combating of the illicit financial flows. That is, before the advent of the agency, the MPA and the DPCI dealt with the financial illicit financial flows where there was a criminal element. Most of the cases prosecuted by the MPA involved matters in relation to tax evasion, exchange control, as well as fraudulent activities committed through Ponzi schemes. The MPA remains reliant on the SARS as well as the South African Reserve Bank to identify criminality which is being referred to the police. The work done by the MPA in combating the illicit financial flows is as follows. That is the total number of cases that have been finalized. That is the information that I had at the time when I compiled this presentation is 16. Total number of cases on the roll is 8. Then I'll just highlight some of the convictions. That is, in respect of the following slides, I will be dealing with the number of finalized cases. Then the highlight of the cases in respect of the case of Solomon Mukwana, who was convicted of 666 counts of contravention of Section 11(1) of the Banks Act 94 of 1990 and sentenced to 150 or 36 months imprisonment, of which 10,000 or 24 months imprisonment was suspended for 5 years. And in addition, let me just scroll this. I know they say matter. The matter in KZN, the conviction was in February or January this year. It involves Mazibuko and Gabuza. They ran a Ponzi scheme where they defrauded members of the public an amount of a total of 64 million. They were convicted on 6,000 and 24 counts of fraud, and 24 counts were minimum penalties. That is where minimum penalties of 15 years are applicable in respect of each count. And that is the total number of sentence of years that they are going to spend, 375 years. And then what I can indicate is what the general has already presented. In respect of most of the cases is where they are accused are arrested at the airports, that is port of entries. And the most of the sentences, I think it's due to the fact that most of the accused plead guilty and most of the monies are taken by the Reserve Bank. That's why the sentences are usually, I'll say that they are lenient, and it's something that we need to look into to ensure that we are effective and send the necessary messages. And those are the cases, and I'm going to deal with the collaboration between the MPA through the SECU with other stakeholders. In 2015, the MPA through the SECU, I just want to indicate that I was responsible for the formation of this dedicated team of prosecutors to assist the Reserve Bank in respect of the TVI project. And during the course of last year, the forensic investigation team did approach the office of the head of the SECU to assist with the repatriation of funds which have been freezed by the London authorities in connection with the TVI project. And then the other, during the course of, I think it was on the 7th day of March, I also attended a meeting that is spearheaded by SEBRIC, where it was agreed that there should be teams formed to address what is called the debit order scams in respect of which there are also illicit financial flows that are committed. And therefore, there's been undertaking on the part of the MPA to make dedicated resources available to the teams that are going to be formed in Gauteng as well as KZN to address this phenomenon. And I think I'll Advocate Molelo will then deal with the involvement of the AFU in respect of matters that are presently dealt with by the agency. And one other issue that I just want to indicate is that despite the fact that we have got constrained resources, the as the coordinator of I'll say serious corruption, financial matters within the SECU, I am well aware of the problems in respect of illicit financial flows and the fact that we, as law enforcement agencies, we need to up our game and ensure that we address them effectively. And one thing that we have not utilized is the provisions of Section 23 of the PRECA, that is, they call it a lifestyle audit. And I've had several meetings with the DPCA. They want to form sort of a committee to address those who are involved, living above their means, to be addressed in terms of Section 23 of the PRECA. And I'm still going to have a meeting with the NDPP to try to address this aspect, because I know the FIC have got a lot of information on people who are not employed, but they've got a lot of cash in the banks and a lot of assets that are not accounted for. And Section 23 is the tool that we all have to use. And I also want to indicate that this is part of last year the CARA funding has been made available to the SECU to come up with a training manual and the provision of Section 23 and other tools that we have in terms of legislation. We are busy compiling the manual, and I think we'll enroll the training during the course of this year just to be effective in addressing corruption and all other crime phenomena that are really, really giving us a problem. Thank you, and over to Advocate Molele.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be quite brief in your presentation. I can confirm indeed that the cases referred to by the DPCI, we've done preservations and confiscation orders. We're working very closely with the FIC and the Reserve Bank. That is by and large the cash that has been picked up, intercepted at the port of entries and the likes. I want to then take it further to relate to perhaps two significant cases that we just finalized in the past month or so. The first one relates to a gentleman by the name of Arnold Benjis. The prosecution commenced in around 2004. He was convicted in 2012. It related to the unlawful harvesting of rock lobster here in the Cape. He got a conviction slapped on the wrist. All the funds were located in the U.S. We then proceeded in terms of our civil recovery mechanism. We did, and with the assistance of both the FIC and the FBI and the crime agency in the UK, we located funds to the amount of about 300 million that were hidden in an account, a trust account in Jersey. I can confirm that last week Friday, we reached, we deposited an amount of 107 million. That was repatriated in terms of the litigation that we finalized late last year in Jersey. That is the first.
So the second one relates to a gentleman by the name of Bobrov. He was a prominent attorney and member of a law society. He defrauded unsuspecting clients in terms of the road accident claims. Just before he was prosecuted, he skipped the country. We then again, through the assistance of our colleagues here, we located an amount of 100 million in Israel that he was in the process of transferring to Australia. We obtained a preservation order, and I can confirm that before end of April, 29th to 30th April, we'll be going for the final forfeiture order, so the matter is in court. I think then the last one, it was rather more about us assisting the Danish authority. One of the officials who was employed in their social services defrauded the state of an amount of 60 million, about which he then paid through a South African local bank account. The money was used to buy the assets. We then obtained 5 preservation orders to the value of 12 million. And the funds are then to be repatriated back to Denmark. I think that is perhaps about all that we can report on, Chair. Thank you.
Questions, comments, because we're taking the Hawks and the NPA together. Alf, Gwen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question about the working groups, there are 2 working groups set up. It seems to have taken quite a long time. We started in 2017 and then sometime in 2018 these were set up. Are they working? How many meetings have they had? Because I think one of our previous meetings, we were quite disappointed at the lack of coordination between the various agencies. So the working groups are set up. Have there been meeting, and how effective are those meetings? Then for both the NPA and the Hawks, the caseloads that you describe don't tell us over what period. Okay, you say some are in the process of investigation, but is that over a 1-year period, a 10-year period? How long is that number of cases? I think there's 77 on the one, if I add up all the columns and so on. What is the period? Just to get a feel, because thank you very much. For how effective the agencies are being compared with the narrative we get about the real extent of the problem. If I just look at it on the surface, it looks like we're just scratching the surface. If indeed the narrative is correct, and at this stage, I have no reason to believe or disbelieve the narrative.
I mean, if you look at both the presentations, I think it obviously is clear that, you know, there is work that is happening, that is underway. But what is difficult for me is that, firstly, I'm not quite sure what you would like us to take away from this briefing. So I just want to make sure that our expectations are matched so that I don't expect, obviously, what you weren't intending to give in this briefing. But I think when something's called a report, I just thought, but perhaps not rightfully so, that we would get a sense of perhaps, for example, what is the overall strategy here? So are there for example, what is your strategy in terms of the types of illicit flows that are being targeted? Are you targeting everything at once, or have you dedicated resources to particular areas? Is there a particular strategy that is being employed towards, I don't know, deterrence, for example, and what is happening there? Are we being successful in those strategies? What are we doing in terms of actual investigation? Are those strategies working? I mean, I would think there's some kind of sense of what is actually happening and is what we're doing successful in those various areas. But then also, you know, questions such as, you know, what are the challenges or weaknesses? How do we even measure success? So it's all very well and good to have anecdotes, and these are great. So here there's one case where X, Y, and Z happened, another case where this happens. But there's no way for me to measure, are we succeeding or are we doing poorly? And what would that measurement look like? What are you measuring yourselves against? So I don't really know how to read this. You know, I could read that these 16 cases have been resolved, but maybe in fact we should have resolved 50 cases. I don't know. So I need something to measure this against to be able to assess whether we're on the right track or not. So it would be quite interesting to find out what are your targets or how do you measure success in this kind of in this area. I think you get my point, but maybe just to give also an example is that, you know, in the, I think the Hawks presentation, it says, and I don't know if you, I think you said these two presentations don't necessarily speak to each other, but we have, for example, that here it says three court cases were finalized, and in brackets it says positive, and then in total in the NPA presentation you say that 16 cases were finalized. So, for example, is it correct to read that 16 cases are finalized but only 3 positively? I mean, we need those kind of then comparisons to make an assessment as to whether we're doing well or not. And there isn't that kind of comparative analysis in this report against any indicators or benchmarks or targets. So one just sees that you resolve positively X number of cases, that X amount of money has been recovered, but one has no way of knowing whether there should be more cases resolved, whether more money should have been retrieved. Just to close off is that I would also like to get a bit more detail on what, as I said, the strategy around, whether it's around more deterrence or really just effective investigation. Are you relying on whistleblowers, on, you know, well, what is the strategy here? And also, should we not have some kind of sense as to whether our strategy our strategies are effective or not?
sorry, Tiki Lady.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. And my apology for the up and down, Chair. I've explained something that one is busy with. And I think, Chairperson, coming from yesterday, one has to give credit where it's due. And my main concern yesterday was about the hope, because what I heard yesterday, I was becoming more and more hopeless and depressed. And fortunately today, I don't know if it's because of what you said yesterday or it's because it's our last meeting of the term. You are just saying goodbye in a nice way. I like it. I have hope I will be able to go in and work. At least there's something that you're doing. All the work that we've been doing, the Financial Intelligence Center, the cases that you're dealing with, and somehow, I don't know, Chairperson, on a lighter note, what does this, all these cases say to you, relate to? You, Mazambani, Tandi, and Peggy, and Nat, who's not here. See? Your province?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mazambani Mazul.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying other provinces are not giving you nightmares. I know they do, but I'm just appreciating.
Remember that Mpumalanga doesn't have a port, right? So you can't really go there.
Well, next to Mozambique, very close. So I'm saying, Chair, I'm very impressed. I just wish that Floyd was here when we get this report, for everybody to have hope and see that something is happening. You are trying your best. And yesterday we raised an issue of maybe you are lacking in terms of capacity and support. Your response has cleared the concerns that we had about you. I just want to say bravo. Thank you so much. And on this one, Chair, I know we have passed this one, this booklet on shifting profits, living wage. I like the message on this one, but I read more on the picture. No, the living wage, it affects more women, black women, braided hair, red lipsticks. I don't know what it means about the red socks, because I'm from the red movement. I'm a communist and I've come from the Red Union. I don't know what it means, but I'm reading a lot in the pictures more than what is written. That was on a lighter note, Chair. Thank you. Thanks for giving me hope.
Look, that booklet I've read before. In fact, I specifically requested you distribute this. I think the point here is the women are representing those who are demanding a living wage.
Yeah.
And what they're basically saying is, if money didn't go out of the country, we, women workers in general, as you know, get paid less. And so the idea, I think, is that's its subtext. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. you want to say something, John? Excuse me.
Thank you, Co-Chair. The Hawks, it certainly seem to be doing a turnaround, but I hope I didn't get the wrong lesson here, that if you are going to do anything illicit, better take cash. You get a lower fine and sentence. You know, you can take bags of that out. The moment you start involving a transaction through the banks, you're going to go for the high jump. So I think that that shouldn't be the message anyone should be getting. But it would have been useful to ensure all of that was also classified under the period of time. When did this take place? And how long did it take to finally process and get a conviction? You know, where is the holdup? Is it on the identification or the process of conviction itself, General? But really, thank you for the information. On the NPA, I just found it somewhat difficult on the one hand, and I think a colleague has already referred to this. You note that a total number of cases is finalized, 16. And then I count about 20, so I'm not sure why I should be getting that figure. And I noticed all of them. I see a couple of cases postponed, two or three of them, but it didn't still quite add up. But again, I mean, I expect we can go through this and try and work out ourselves when it occurred, but it would be useful if we know the time frame that this took for the various actions to take place. What is the impediment here? Where are some of the blockages? And that's not coming through very clearly to me at all. But yes, it's rather pleasing to see some progress is being made. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, firstly to say that compared to other submissions you've made, if you look at three of your inputs now, there is a marginal improvement, so we welcome it. Secondly, given the colossal scale of what's happening, while we welcome this progress, it's far too little, as I think you'll also acknowledge. Far too little. A lot of these are small cases. Obviously, you're not a judge. It's not your call as the NPA, even, what sentences the people get. But, I mean, it's terribly light. These people, I suspect, are serial transgressors, Dicaletti. I know some of the cases in Dynamics who come from that community, right? And these are serial transgressors. These are small amounts for them. I'm sure the very next day they've thought of some other way of doing it, right? So obviously you can't be held to account for what the magistrates and the judges decide. But a very small slap on the wrist of conviction, fine is what they're getting. It's, the next day they send out far more, I'm sure, than what they are accused of having sent out. So it's not a deterrent. I say deterrent. Doesn't deter them. Yeah. Secondly, given that, the last figure I saw for what it's worth is 50 billion rands a year disappearing, given that big capital is not really here, it's like we're dealing with maybe small fry, but that's important. It's signaling, So we know that you are highly stressed in respect of lack of forensic technical and other related experts, right? So it's for us to put pressure, on the chairpersons of your committee, Justice and Police, to put pressure on the incoming committees. I'll speak to both the chairs now, the Chair of Justice this afternoon in the House and the Chair of Police, to say, look, please, put more pressure I have spoken to the one minister, I'll speak to the other minister. But on illicit financial flows, the Minister of Police is very keen to take things further. So what we're saying is that, yes, we welcome the progress, but it's so, you know, as you'll agree, excessively, a small pittance for what is due to us as a country. But as Di Kaleri says, progress, as my comrade here says, progress. Quickly respond, and then we hand over to Joan. We'll take over from here.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. Firstly, the question as to how many meetings are being held and how effective these meetings are. There are regular meetings that are being held, and they are supposed to be on a monthly basis. They are being held on two levels. There are those meetings on principal level and those on operational level. And I think that my colleagues that are coordinating this will be able to come in. The period of the cases that we are talking about, we carry them from month to month, so we can say that they come back from 2017, so we carry over. Some of them get disposed along the way. As we have indicated, it's only in a particular field. The figures obviously depend on what date of the month have you taken your figures on. Like if the NPA would be getting update today, whereas we may have got the update 6 days before, you may find that there is also some differences. So the period itself starts from 2017, where there was this discussion and arrangement that we should monitor this type of cases. The strategy and the what determines this, whether it's whistleblower or whether we just want to deter, it is based on the modus operandi. From time to time, the modus operandi will be changing. Most of this, obviously, is you have got false invoicing. It's one type of modus operandi. You have got people who will obviously be transferring funds out of the country, like those who are working elsewhere in the country and then sending the money elsewhere as a way of paying somebody across, not knowing that you are actually violating the regulations. But as you can see from the stats, most of these are those that individuals want to carry across the border, human couriers. Some of them you often find that it is actually not their money, which is why you find that they don't want to fight for that one. If anything can be done to take away the money and then they get whatever, they want to quickly have the matter finalized, which you can see that it means that somebody else may be financing this. If it is your money, you wouldn't like to be taking those risks. Those are the ones that are in the majority. There are other modus operandi that I would not disclose publicly that we are working on. So there are other modus operandi that we are dealing with, a number of them, which we are working on them. I wouldn't like to deal with them now, as they are still cases that are alive. So the modus operandi is the one that dictate the approach. You have got some of these matters that you pick them up when you are dealing with organized crime matters. there are those that you will pick up when you deal with the commercial crime, generic investigation, major investigations. The issue of the targets, this one is just very difficult to set a target to know precisely how many are you dealing with. So while we would like to be dealing with whatever we come across, the setting of targets is problematic. We also do not have specific codes on our system that we must always go and drill among the charges that this is one of those that involve illicit finance flow, money laundering. Most of them will also have that element. So the setting of targets is, I think, difficult to set, or what is the target that you would like to be achieving. We want to stamp out the whole scheme, but it's the figures that one does not know regarding the target. I have dealt with the issue of the period. I think the Reserve Bank may also want to add on some of the matters that I have not dealt with, that is obviously also part of the strategy how we deal with these matters. Yeah, I think those are the responses that I can advance, Chairperson. Maybe some of my colleagues might want to add.
Anybody wants to add?
Yes, and I have the following. The issue of the strategy to address the illicit financial flows will be dealt with by the FIC. And then that is the other strategy in terms of which we have got an agency. There's the agency, that one. I've already indicated the issue of the utilization of Section 23 of the PRECA. That is another strategy that we're going to adopt in order to address suspicious transactions. And the one challenge that we have and we have grappled with in respect of these cases is to charge the accused with money laundering. The problem is that you've got certain requirements for a prosecutor to bring a charge of money laundering where you do not have an element of proof. It's in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, you need, in order for you to charge someone with money laundering, there should be, you must prove that the money is proceeds of unlawful activities. And if someone is just found in possession of a lot of cash, that element, you're going to find that you always have a challenge as far as that is concerned. I remember that there are some cases that we had to withdraw due to the fact that we could not charge the accused on the basis of on the charge of money laundering. And then pertaining to targets, what I want to indicate is the following. The issue of targets is usually problematic. If you want to deal with organized crime, you want to deal with, to be effective, if you start to deal with issues of targets, you are going to end up chasing numbers. And most of the time when you chase numbers, you are going to target small fishes instead of dealing with crimes in a bigger picture. And I want to thank the compliment that we received pertaining to, our efforts as far as addressing the illicit financial flows. And just want to make an undertaking, as I did yesterday. As far as Stanoff is concerned, we're going to come up with strategies, and when we present the report next time, I think everyone will be pleased with the report that you're going to present. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else we want to say? Gwen, yes. Very quickly, please.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to say that So, I mean, I think your answer about not having targets, I mean, makes perfect sense. But I wasn't suggesting, I mean, you're the expert in this area. I'm saying, how do you measure success? So if it's not targets, what is it then? So what I want to hear from you, how is it that you define, I mean, there must be some way in which you're analyzing whether you're doing a good job or not.
I want to suggest that is perhaps one of the challenges. What Mpo, Advocate Duvall has mentioned, it talks to a few issues that we're obviously grappling with. It's not so much about the challenge of the law. Let me start with, you know, the issue point. It's more about changing the mindset of even NPA itself. You know, we're fighting with colleagues, amongst our own colleagues, to say, look, you're sitting, you have a scenario where the person is caught up at the border with an obscene amount of money in circumstances that they cannot explain. Their money is a crime, so we need to start investigating around that. So it's not a traditional or conventional way of saying, well, here's a dead body, the smoking gun, and blood spatters on the thing. So it is really a new crime phenomenon that is indeed, and correctly so, challenged, you know, the way we do things. So the next point is then to say, part of what we are doing through our colleagues is to try and develop those communities of practices that can talk to tackling this kind of crimes. Now, in government, again, I think the challenge has always been setting targets that will give you a meaningful way of gauging the impact you're making in that focus area. You know? So I think that's one of the things that we'll need. A lot has been written about the illicit financial flows. I think part of what we'd like to do is to come up with an impact assessment tool, and there's a lot of aspects in that regard that should be able to assist us, so that we can really gauge the type of impact we're making, not so much about how many cases finalized. The question is, well, so what? What does it mean? If you imagine the criminal pie chart around this financial flows, the work we're doing here is just baby steps. So we still find there's a long way that we can do. So essentially, those are some of the issues that we do acknowledge, you know, as part of the challenges that we hope to address in the near future.
Okay, is that okay? It's ongoing. We're saying we welcome the progress. There's still a long way to go. You will be hopefully appearing every quarter as arranged, twice a year, multi-committees, but your respective portfolio committees will engage with you quarterly. So we're moving to the FIC, and Comrade John will chair and spot till the end. Everybody's got 10 minutes. We do not have to take the full 10 minutes if it's not necessary. We want action, please. Thank you. So over to you, John.
Thank you very much, co-chair. Where is Vic? Financial. Oh, right, over there. You're very welcome. Who's actually going to make the presentation or lead it?
I'll be leading the presentation, but I'm with three colleagues here. My name is Polsile Kanyile, Director of FIC. I'm accompanied by the Head of Monitoring and Analysis, who is chairing the working group that you have heard from the colleagues. I'm also accompanied by the Senior Manager in the Monitoring Space, Mr. Peter Albert, as well as Christopher Malan, the Executive in Charge of Compliance. Due to time constraints, we won't really start. You've got a copy of our presentation. We won't start on page 1. We'll start on page 7, just to give a background of this working group, and also touch on the perspective of the FIC in as far as these matters are concerned. Dr. Masiabadu, will you please start?
Thanks, Chair and committee members. As reflected, just for key contextual purpose, committee members will note that since the last time we interfaced with the committee, I suppose 2017, there has been the point that we had to start working together. So first and foremost was obviously the establishment of this interagency working group, as reflected on page 7 of the slides. But the key issue to note in that context is that we had to locate this particular interagency working group in the bigger scheme of things. And that is why at the apex you will see what is called the interdepartmental working group on anti-money laundering as well as countering the financing of terrorism. That is the bigger group that is chaired by the DG in Treasury, which is inclusive of a multiplicity of DGs as well as heads of entities across the country that is seeking to address the issues as they were. The most critical one to look at is the one we are talking about today on the left. That is the Inter-Agency Working Group on Illicit Financial Flows. You will see the other two is on National Risk Assessment and the one on Mutual Evaluation, which we are not talking to today. Now, the first issue to note there is the fact that how is this structure actually working operationally and the interfaces, particularly in view of responding to the question about the meetings. Let me talk, therefore, in the context of the inter-agency working group. Below that, you will see there are two subgroups. The first group is the operational inter-agency working group. That is the one that is being chaired by the Financial Intelligence Center. This particular group meets once every month. Up to this point, we have met around 14 times, which is throughout the course of last year, as well as two times this year. And that is how much we have been basically met. That particular group that we chair as the FIC basically does the overall coordination and the direction that we have to be doing in terms of illicit financial flows matters. But the most critical team is the one that is on the left, the task working group. The task working group is chaired by the asset forfeiture unit coming from the National Prosecuting Authority together with the South African Revenue Services. That is the actual team that coordinates the actual investigators on the ground, who actually does the investigation work and interfaces with all of the critical stakeholders on the ground who are therefore doing the actual work, as we are going to talk about the actual work as we speak. On the left-hand side, those are just the agencies, as you can see them there, the Hawks, your Financial Sector Conduct Authority, as well as the Special Investigating Unit and all of those colleagues. Now, let's then quickly reflect on the issue that was also raised a bit in the context of what is our strategic approach in terms of looking at issues of illicit financial flows in the country, which will then start to contextualize issues around the strategic approach. The first issue here was, in the context of the issue as it were, there has been a different ways of looking into the issue, people understanding illicit financial flows differently, and therefore there hasn't been a collective understanding. That is the next slide, slide 8. In this particular slide, you will see that we had to engage and practically agree on the definition of illicit financial flows, which is then going to be a strategic guide in terms of how we are going to be doing the work. If you look into the definition, we talk about it is about the illegal movement of money or capital, as it were, primarily from one country to another. And in that context, we also talk about funds that had been illegally earned or transferred or even utilized. That is the context through which we are then moving through the work that we do. When we talk about illegally earned money, then we talk about the proceeds. And the proceeds there, as you can see, we are giving you typical examples through which proceeds get generated. It could be in the context of drug trafficking. It could be in the context of fraudulent activity or even in terms of theft. And within the context of the legislative framework that presupposes the work that we do, it is therefore provided for in POCA, that is the Prevention and Combating of Corruption Activities Act, as it were. Now, the other issue that becomes very critical, which is not that well understood, is the fact that you can have money that is legally earned, but the moment that money gets illegally transferred, therefore it becomes the context through which illicit financial flows therefore get contextualized. Legislatively, then we could talk about the flouting of the exchange control provisions. And in that context, we are then able to ensure that that particular proceed is therefore part of the illicit financial flows. A typical example in this context is the cash mules, as you will note them, the ones that get picked up in the airport in a number of times. And mostly those issues are fairly covered in the bigger scheme of things. Now, in the context of the work of the illicit financial flows working group that is coordinated, we then agree with the principle that says there are cases that we have to be dealing with as a collective, sitting in one spot where we then address those cases. But at the same time, there are run-of-the-mill cases that are being dealt with on a daily basis by agencies individually. And as you have had now the presentation from the from NPA as well as from the Hawks, they were presented primarily those that are dealing with as agencies standing by themselves, although interfacing, but not necessarily within the context. In this context, we then agreed on the case selection criteria upon which we are able to bring in the cases in the context of the working group. And this is the criteria. First part, we are saying it is a case that is supposed to be falling within the case description in terms of the definition of IFF. Secondly, we are looking at cases that at least are sitting at a minimum threshold of at least over 100 million. It means those that are below that are then handled by agencies as we stand. And therefore, we are also able to say those kind of cases that are sophisticated, that then touches the jurisdictions of agencies beyond only one. Therefore, when it touches on three, the typical example, if there are fraudulent activities that have some tax element, that have some exchange control flouting element, therefore it's three agencies, we therefore enroll that kind of a case, and then therefore we are being able to deal with those. And of course, as I indicated, those that fall outside this are therefore handled in terms of that context. And therefore, in terms of where we are today as we speak, we are having eight cases enrolled, and we are going to give you a strategic reflection in terms of where we are on those cases without necessarily going into the tactical narrative as the cases are actually live. The next slide basically just contextualizes the issue before we go to the cases, and that says, if you look into the high-level panel, which is the highly cited provision, that was led by the former president, Mbeki, in the context of the amount lost. It talked about 50 million being lost by the continent, probably to the globe. And now the question is, how much are we losing as the country? And that is the bigger question. So as we were doing work in this context as the Illicit Financial Flows Working Group, it became clear that still there is no strategic picture in terms of the threat picture that we are dealing with on illicit financial flows. It was on the basis of that wherein the working group therefore requested the director to write to the coordinator of intelligence under the structure called NICOC, the National Intelligence Coordination Committee. They are currently convening a multidisciplinary team that is busy studying the threat of illicit financial flows in the country broadly, and they seek to give us an understanding of the magnitude of the threat, including the nature of the figures that we are losing as a country. And we consider this to be very critical in guiding the work that we need to be doing going forward in terms of the strategic flow. Let's then move into the next slide. The next slide, therefore, talks to the actual cases. I'll be very quick on the cases. There are eight in number. We have categorized them as IFF1, as you can see, 2018 onwards, IFF2 until IFF8. Now, the first case is basically the case that involves an activity that borders around a Ponzi scheme approach. In this particular case, in terms of the investigative work that has been done thus far, we are able to see that around 126 million has been lost by the country in as far as this issue is concerned. In terms of the agencies involved, are those agencies that are being flagged out there as it stands. The current status in as far as this particular case is concerned, you will note that there is a warrant of arrest that has been issued as we speak, and the suspect in this particular case has been flagged as we speak in the Interpol blue notice, as it were. We are currently looking at the options of having to look at the extradition issues, and we are therefore working with the Department of Justice around the issues of mutual legal assistance to be able to deal with the issue, as it were. Over and above that, we have managed to have 70 million being frozen by the South African Reserve Bank up to this point as we speak, and therefore the criminal investigation is underway, as it were, and we are therefore moving in the context of the financial movement, and that is why the FIC in particular then comes out handy there. As we speak now, we are able to obtain around 61 bank accounts that has been involved in as far as this matter is concerned, and we are also going to, in a way, bring in some forensic accountants into the space to be able to assist us to address the issues, as it were. The asset forfeiture unit, in terms of this particular case, they are in the process of putting through preservation orders in terms of making sure that you are able to capture the assets that are currently being...
You only have 4 minutes left.
Yeah. So, first, the next case is purely on exchange control contraventions, and in this particular one, We are talking about 700 million being exported illegally out of the country, as it were. Those are the critical role players, as you can see. 42 million being frozen by the Reserve Bank as we speak. And this is basically the provision as it stands. And the AFU is looking into the issues of the preservation orders, as it were. In terms of IFF number 3, it is also around the issues of exchange controls issues. In this particular one, 397 million has been taken out of the country, and those are the critical role players that are involved. At least we've managed to freeze around 10 million, as it were, by the Reserve Bank. And as we speak, SARS also is basically looking into the matter, particularly around the issues of price misinvoicing, as it were. And SARS is also moving in terms of criminal prosecutions. And of course, the AFU is also looking into the possible preservations, as it were. In terms of IFF 4, this one is primarily about the transfer of illicit profits from transnational movement in the context of rhino poaching, as we will know it. And in this context, around 2.7 billion has been lost, as it were. And these are the other the critical role players, as you can see them. And at the bottom part, they then reflect all the other critical figures that are being involved. And then you can see subs there having convicted one of the fellows on the ground. In terms of IFF number 5, it is on the Hawala provision, and therefore those are the critical role players that are also involved there. In terms of IFF number 6, it is also in terms of cash seizures, primarily in the port of entry, and as you can see, those are the critical role players involved. IFF 7, this one is mainly on money laundering as well as corruption. And you can see on this one, we say the actual loss is not yet determined, and we are working to make sure that it is basically looked through. In terms of IFF number 8, which is the last one, is primarily on organized crime syndicates. And as you can see, those are the critical role players involved. In this particular one, around 175 accounts had been blocked as we speak. So let's then look into the key slide number 20. That then reflects, in a way, the report that has been issued into the role players in as far as the investigative work is concerned, primarily from the Financial Intelligence Center side of things. The first indication there is that we're able to issue out what we call the proactive financial intelligence report arising out of what has been picked up in as far as these issues are concerned. 32 of those have been issued in supporting the investigation, and those are the reports that talks about all the financial movements and all of that. And then in that context, you could see, in terms of the response, we have 17 of those. We are sitting with 45 reports that have been issued that have been looked at up to this point, as it were. Entities involved, around 237 entities, plus around 87 fellows involved. And out of that, we are talking about 326 fellows involved. So that is, in short, the provision in terms of the work of the working group, and of course the technicalities might be the issue of time, but that's the essence. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, can I just plead for indulgence, just 2 minutes? May I ask Mr. Malan to touch on the way forward?
With your indulgence, Chair and committee members, we are very hopeful in the future on how to better structure our collaborative efforts. We have two initiatives where we think we can make a difference. Over and above the structure, we are working on a fusion center concept. That essentially means the FIC will set aside time at its offices and space with the necessary equipment to house a working group as and when structured by the various principals. They will come to the FIC and we will work jointly on matters on an ongoing basis until we have an outcome. Over and above that, this is just not a story about law enforcement. The input side is very important, and the input side is what the banking sector is actually reporting to us. We are also working with National Treasury under the guidance of the DTG, who is here today. He can also talk about it. We are working very firmly with the banking sector to involve them in a partnership with ourselves as FIC to be the link to ensure that we get better reporting and more meaningful reporting, and we'll work it through the structures so that we can help the overall effort to deal with this issue. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I think in closure, I must say coordination is there and it has highly improved. What we need is tighter controls, and more importantly, to capacitate the NPA in as far as the prosecution of these matters as well as the hawks, Because at the moment, even though we've got a working group that is really dedicated on these matters, they are still carrying other high priority matters. So if you are saying you've got dedication, that dedication really is meaningless if people who have been assigned to these working groups are carrying other big cases, which really touches on the issue that is known by all of the shortages of people, of resources in the prosecution space as well as in the Hawke space. But I must say we work very, very, very well and very, very close with each other. Mm-hmm. And the quick wins that we are really trying to plan right. in our plan, which we see as something that we can easily achieve, because you cannot talk about targets when you cannot really achieve such targets. We are looking at really hitting the criminals where it hurts the most. If you can really focus on the criminal or on the civil forfeitures of assets in cases, whilst you are waiting for those complex cases involving multiple accused to be enrolled for trial, the members of the public can really see that the justice system, together with the FIC, because we also carry an interest in these
right.
cases. We want to see that way we have really given products to the prosecution and to asset forfeiture. Those products lead to a successful prosecution. They lead to a successful asset forfeiture recovery as well as repatriation of assets. Thank you.
Now, thank you very much. Director Kanyili, I wish we did have more time, but we really can't give everyone 20 minutes. Thank you. Honourable members, do you have any comments or questions? Just by a show of hands.
I must say, listening to the input, it's encouraging again. You see, if you compare it to previous inputs, obviously the task that you have is unenviable, and I think, you know, it's going in a positive direction. We've been despairing, to be quite honest, over the last 3 years, and suddenly things are picking up. So I think it looks good. Obviously, remember, we now have experience. When we came in 94, we used to get impressed with meetings and number of meetings. Now, we look at results, the productivity and so on. There seems more coordination. There seems more verve and drive coming from the FIC. It's quite the best report I've seen today. I really think, I mean, from the state agencies, it's encouraging. That's how I feel. Thank you.
Right. It was clear that presentation was very effectively given. Members welcome it, and they don't have any questions at this point of time. So can we thank you and move across to SARS, South African Revenue Services, and we have a couple of people here from SARS who are with us. Who's actually going to give it? Is it Mr. Malan or Mr. Alberts who's going to give the presentation?
Honourable Chair, honourable members, my name is Peter Parchimus. I will be presenting the presentation from SARS. I'm accompanied by Nicholas Namalili, and we'll be the ones taking you through the SARS presentation. The SARS presentations focus mainly on two aspects. One is the strategies on what SARS one is planning to address illicit flow of funds, and it focuses on two specific aspects. The one is how we deal with the illicit economy as such, of where the cash generation is from illicit source, and then as well the funds then being moved across border. And there's a distinct difference on how we deal with the illicit economy and that of BEPS we do with transfer pricing and capitalization. We will then further focus, as requested, more on the actions and the deliveries that has been taken since our previous presentations to the relevant committees. The context of the presentation is that in previous presentations it was highlighted that there has been a lot of suspicious transaction reports presented to SARS, and that equals tax evasion. And we just want to clear that aspect that from a FRC perspective, the suspicious transactions report does not equal tax evasion. It is a suspicious transactions report, and I need to support the focus of our colleagues within the FRC that the cooperation within the multi-agency work group has done quite a significant improvement in how we move along within the focus on IFFs. From a SARS mitigating strategy, at a strategic level, we focus on the public and private in international cooperation, on how we obtain data and focus on detecting and preventing IFFs. There's been a huge focus on a country-by-country reporting, and we can say that is one of the highlights within the approach in obtaining information. We are focusing on a digital economy strategy and to enhance the legislation. I think our colleagues within the SAPS have also focused on that. But most importantly is the enhanced and integrated risk management on how SARS look at a group of individuals that is part and parcel of a huge focus. From a tactical approach, we are saying we've established an integrated investigation within the illicit economy and the capacitating of our large business center, and bringing back some of that capability and focus. A priority focus on organized crime and tax and customs evasion. On a tactical level, the increase of the electronic cargo manifest by sea and rail, and that's increased by 70%. The implementation of a fiscal marker within the track and trace when it comes to tobacco tobacco and cigarettes is one of the key focuses on how we can bring control up front in that process. And customs inclusive and non-intrusive driven intervention and the deployment of our air cargo scanners at Ortia and mobile cargo scanners at City Deep has gone a long way in detecting some of these IFFs. And then the improve customs risk identification and target capabilities, and then also the accreditation of 27 level 2 preferred traders, we believe is going to alleviate a lot of burden moving forward. On the next slide, it only depicts what you've seen here. We see ourselves as SARS as part of a greater enforcement system, and it's only if this system functions effectively that we can really make an impact on IFFs. From an overview of the FRC referral, SARS has received over the past 4 years 623 suspicious transaction reports. From these transaction reports, it is very important that I highlight, if we get a suspicious transaction report today, the taxpayer first has to file their return. So if we receive it today, it falls within the next filing season, where the closing date will be August. So we're already a year and a half down the line before there's an obligation placed upon the taxpayer to file associated to a specific transaction. SARS uses the information that we've obtained from the FIC to enhance our risk profiling capabilities. So as soon as the taxpayer files, we are ready to act. Within this aspect, SARS has dealt with 82 of these cases. 58 of these cases were determined as low risk. 9 investigative audits were completed associated with these STRs, and that led to assessments being raised with over 1 billion rand. There's currently 15 live cases associated with some of these STRs. It's important to note that this information competes against all other priorities of SARS. There is no mandatory obligation, such as with POCA, that we have to investigate, we must investigate all these transactions. And it's quite important that the committee takes note of that. From the 8 cases from the multi-agency work group, I think our colleagues within FRC have done justice to that overview. For the sake of time, I want to move on to the additional actions taken by SARS. And this is also in addition to the previous reports that focuses on the advanced payments and also the customs risk associated with transfer pricing. So from a customs and excise point of view, there was a detection of 64.9 million of cash trying to be taken out of our country. We've also have a deployment of personnel at certain of the cigarette manufacturing sites. We raised 464 million in schedules in the tobacco, clothing, alcohol and fuel industry, where we see the IFFC squad rife. And we've detained 381 tons worth of tobacco. And that is for this financial year, yeah, up to date. From a base erosion and profit shifting point of view, there has been a total of 42 orders being completed, and the assessments raised is 651 million. So that capability is taking off. From a criminal investigation point of view, 277 active investigations which relate to VAT fraud, where we've seen money has also found its way offshore. 68 cases has been handed over to the MPA regarding to this within this financial year, and there was 35 convictions. From a focus and from the establishment of the illicit economy unit, they are focusing on the focus areas as highlighted in the presentation: tobacco, gold, alcohol, cash and carry, textile, the illicit financial flows is specific there, and then VAT carousels. There we've got 15 projects with 902 cases. The prejudice associated with that is 9.8 billion, of which 1.4 billion rands worth of assets is under preservation order. And that is the illicit economy, the recently established illicit economy unit that had those successes. I'm now going to hand over to my colleague.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much.
You've actually got 3.5 minutes left.
Great. Now, I will just take you through some. I'm sure you are aware that SARS is currently running the SVDP project, Special Voluntary Disclosure Program. Just to give you an update as to where we are as an organization, of 2030 applications that we received, we managed to finalize so far 1,806. Of that, we are actually left with about 224 applications that is work in progress that we are currently busy with. Just to give you in terms of the monetary value out of the program, we've managed to sign or enter into an agreement amounting to 4.3 billion rand, of which 4.1 billion has been banked. So it's the money that is currently sitting in our fiscal. So we are also very excited to report that this program has actually yielded the foreign assets value, the assets that were previously not known by SARS, amounting to 27 billion rand. So 27 billion rand worth of foreign assets is now known, and we are putting measures within SARS to actually continue monitoring these assets to ensure future declarations with regard to those assets that were previously hidden. So I will also touch on the way forward with regard to our contribution to the intergovernmental cooperation. We will continue to support and strengthen this intergovernmental cooperation as SARS. We will also, as you know, continue to strengthen our capabilities within PEP space, in particular with case profiling and auditing space. We are continuing to increase our presence in the manufacturing sites of cigarettes. We need to be there when this manufacturing takes place, and we are building capacity for our permanent illicit economic unit. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I thought, honourable members, that what we could consider doing is immediately take SARB and then have some engagement on the matter. Yeah, but we can do SARB. Right. And from SARB, South African Reserve.
South African Reserve Bank. My name is Elijah Masbuba. I'm the head of Financial Surveillance Department.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't get that.
My name is Elijah Masbuba. I'm the head of Financial Surveillance Department in the SARB. I'm accompanied by Thais Pason, the head of Compliance and Enforcement, and Andre Malherbe, the manager in the Compliance and Enforcement Division of the bank.
Yes.
So we will split the presentation between myself and Andre, but I just want to highlight in terms of what the SAB has been doing. We have seen in a number of slides where, you know, it is mentioned in terms of the blocking of money in various cases. So we have, over the years, been trying to taking several steps to detect, disrupt, and deter illicit financial flows. And these measures include increasing the capacity to detect and analyze and investigate and report suspicious cross-border transactions. We have embarked on a major project in terms of upgrading our reporting system to the level where it will be able to capture various types of transactions, including what was alluded to this morning, like your digital and all that. So it's a big project that will take a number of years to capture quite a lot of information into the system. And then conducting an awareness campaign involving authorized dealers to promote the early detection and reporting of suspicious cross-border transactions and activities involving, you know, the ADS clients. Because the banks, we had to go and train them in terms of sensitizing them to be very much watchful and be vigilant in terms of what is happening in their space and what to look for so that they can be able to report to the Reserve Bank. And then sharing information with other authorities that has been alluded to, and participating in multi-agency working group, including law enforcement, which has been established to target illicit financial flows. Now, in the interest of time, I'll go to slide number 3 and skip other slides, and just enforcement actions. So we have looked at the two periods. The last period on your right there, you'll see that it is 2017, from 2015 to 2017. March, it's the last time we reported on these figures, so, and then currently up to the end of Feb this year. So in terms of the total funds that were blocked previously at the end of March 2017, it was 487 million, and then currently for this period is 1.97 billion. And focusing on the current period, number of cases involved, 259, and out of those cases, there are 641 accounts that were involved. And then forfeiture notices, because, you know, a blockage precedes the forfeiture. There's quite a process involved in that regard. Total funds forfeited out of the 1.97, 256 million. And I know somebody immediately, a question crops up when you look on the right where previously 487 million and 371 million was forfeited. This is work in progress. In terms of our regulations, when we start the case, we have to conclude it within 3 years. So it's still work in progress around those cases that comprise that 1.97 billion. And then number of cases out of the forfeited amount is 81, and number of accounts, they were 182. And then the collaboration, slide number 4, collaboration with other stakeholders. I think last time when here we were encouraged to actually work, so, and which was happening in the previous period, you can see between ourselves and the FIC, and then from us to the FIC, and then your SARS, SEPs, NPA, and AFU, and then referrals to SARS, and criminal cases reported as well. And then the last slide, which is slide number 6, collaboration with stakeholders, criminal cases reported since last feedback in March. 7 cases successfully prosecuted, 2 cases declined, and 2 cases currently in court. I'll give to Andre just to continue.
Thank you, Chair. Andre Malherbe. So I was just asked to briefly go through some of the recent interventions or specific cases. So the recent cases, a set of schemes, a new MO that we detected. I'm not going to go into the details. It's still ongoing investigation, but to make a long story short, we could block 74 million there. We also estimated a further 2 billion in IFFs were prevented as a result of this intervention. Debit credit cards, I think last year for the first time in history, the number of foreign exchange transactions done with credit cards and debit cards exceeded the number of transactions done through other means. Not in value, but in number. So that's become a problem, and we intervened there in a big matter where it was a simple matter of cash being deposited in SA and then being withdrawn overseas in cash. Our systems detected that there was a common denominator in terms of the merchants or the ATMs where the funds were withdrawn, and the repetitive transactions. We intervened there. There were all the measures implemented to stop it from happening again. These included certain limits that were placed on cards for, in terms of foreign spend, and identifying these excessive cash withdrawals. I think my colleagues in the other agencies have mentioned the Ponzi schemes. That is the QSG matter, where we blocked the 70 million and handed the matter over to AFU. That is ongoing investigation. And the last one is it had to do with unauthorized export and sale of aircraft. So there's two aircraft that were exported by a specific family and then sold abroad without the necessary approval. And we intervened when the sale proceeds were paid to a local bank. That was 19 million. So that's my story. Thanks.
That was very succinct. Thank you very much, both presenters there. Members, you know, you did have the opportunity for the FIC to engage, but we can look at them again if something has cropped up. But we could engage at this point now, SARS, SARB, and if you thought of something, you can go on to FIC. We look at those because what is certainly I've realized is the amount of collaboration that is needed to effectively prosecute and deal with the challenges we're facing with illicit financing. And we saw the start off with FIC going into SARS there and so on. And before I ask a few questions and make further comments, let me ask members to engage. Just by show of hands, yes, Honourable Lees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. The tobacco industry. You say you've stepped up presence in the manufacturing sector. What is that? What is the outcome of that? I mean, is the discovery that it's a major problem, or they're just sitting there and actually there is no problem? What is the outcome there? And this interesting this family that's involved in the aircraft sale, who are they?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Comrade Jefferson. I think we need to give credit where credit is due. According to my observation, I can see that what we're always complaining about, that is collaboration, it is now happening, and we are really appreciative of all the good work that has been happening throughout, you know, the whole process. Chair, I just want to make one comment or maybe pose a question. It doesn't seem that the all agencies have now tried to scratch the surface regarding illicit financial flows that have to do with digital economy. Would you say you are doing something with regards to that?
Thank you very much. Honourable Ngwenya.
Following on from that digital economy comment, I just wanted to get a sense, as it was one of the things highlighted, I think, as far as the mitigation strategy, is to get a sense of, I mean, obviously by the nature of these kinds of activities, because they're illegal, they're obviously undeclared, so I get that, but is there some way in which we have a sense as to the contribution of the digital economy? You know, because obviously I assume, you know, we've been targeting, for example, tobacco, and now it seems, well, you know, digital economy seems to be another sort of area of sector that we're looking at, and how are these areas of focus sort of landed upon? Why that, as opposed to another area of the economy? And could we get a sense of what is perhaps the expected contribution to towards IFFFs from this particular area. And I'd also be interested just in a bit of elaboration of what you mean by enhanced legislation. Are you just referring to what's already been done in the past, that we have seen some activity in these areas, or are you making a more forward-looking statement that there's actually more legislation afoot covering these particular areas? I mean, as an example with blockchain, you know, there hasn't really been anything concrete yet. I just want to make sure I get the intention of the statement correct. So I know there was that, you know, that white paper in 2014, and now more recently there was that consultation paper, you know, which started to hint at towards actually now regulation as opposed to just these consultative kind of papers. And is that what you mean, that there's a really discussion to put that together? And is there any kind of legislative timeline then, if you're talking about forward-looking legislation in each of those areas? Is there some kind of timeline which you expect to be releasing further, you know, further legislative proposals in those areas? The other question I had was more for Saab, I think, which was to ask, you know, when we're looking at illicit financial flows, is there a way in which, I mean, this question might sound funny, so I'm trying to make sure I phrase it properly, but is there a way to decipher how much of it is people engaging in that activity out of pure, you know, whether it's just greed or malevolence, whatever the case may be, and those who might just be trying to look for shortcuts? So the intention is not really to do anything illegal, but some law or other is too onerous, so they're trying to do something quickly or more cheaply, I don't know, whatever the case may be. So, and in that case, there might be a need to explore whether or not some of the, you know, well, obviously this again comes in, there will be a difference of party view on here, but whether our exchange controls, for example, contribute to that kind of activity at all. Is there something about our regulations and rules that we should perhaps change or look at and to make sure that people who wouldn't ordinarily be engaging in illicit activity wouldn't find themselves engaging it purely because it's actually the laws that are perhaps now outdated or inappropriate, as opposed to those who are intentionally, whatever the law may be, they are going to actually just look for ways to circumvent it. Hopefully.
Right. No, thank you very much. Something I was just quite interested in myself, under the VAT fraud here, is that in a particular industry? Is it prevalent in a particular industry, or is it just broad? The other issue is, as you probably know, you had quite a few computer glitches in SARS, which led to duty-free goods streaming in. Perhaps you could just ensure that we're not having any glitches, computer glitches, with respect to illicit transfers. That's the SARS issue there. But I must say, since the last presentation I received about 2-3 months ago, everyone there does show improvement and progress. Thank you very much. To the SARB, you've also been here. How well are you tracking issues with the banks? Because we seem to rely on more post-mortems than early detection. Thank you. Who's going to take the first bite? SARS. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Seeming I'll take the first bite, as most of the questions directed at SARS. First of all, the outcome from the personnel being placed at cigarette manufacturers. It's quite early days, but it's the intention to start monitoring what is the production currently compared to prior to the personnel being placed there. And surely we'll give feedback to this committee in our next presentation. From a digital economy point of view, it's also early days. We are developing the strategy, and we've dealt with a few cases. And within dealing with these few cases, there's some shortcomings that we've seen within legislation that can make it easier for SARS to control the declarations within this industry. But I will provide a follow-up on the questions to this. And then the note regarding the computer glitches is noted, and we'll try our best.
South African Reserve Bank?
I'll answer the question on the so-called funny question that was posed in terms of the behavior of people taking money offshore or illegally. And I'll just give a brief background and say, you would recall that in 2003, we, together with SARS, we declared an amnesty, and it was called SARS exchange control amnesty, where a number of South Africans, in terms of having placed their assets or unauthorized assets offshore, have to come back and declare. So, and that process yielded assets of 68.3 billion at that particular time in terms of hidden assets around the world, and there were levies that were paid around 2.68 billion. And then there was another one in 2010, but another one in 2010 was just an exchange control that we declared as SARB. It was not as successful, because for an amnesty to be successful, when you talk about irregular funds, you know, people always want to be cleared on both sides. And what I mean by that is that you want to be cleared on exchange control and also be cleared on SARS, because the issue of trust always plays a role here, because you have been we have been talking about collaboration, that there's a likelihood that if SARS deals with an issue, they might take that file to SARS to deal. So you know, the public always find comfort when you work together to say all my cases will be cleared and there's not going to be an outstanding case. And then there was the last SVDP that SARS alluded to in 2016. The SARB, currently where we stand, we should finalize the process by the end of June. 50 billion assets, or slightly more than 50 billion assets, have been declared. And then we are standing at 2.75 billion in levies that we have been, that have been collected. And these monies, you might regard them as illegal, maybe monies gained, but it's mostly people's money that for a different reason, they are trying to hide it away in a different tax jurisdiction, maybe for whatever reason, to say, let me hide this money for my kids, because if somebody might say, you know, I'm not sure about the future of my pensions in South Africa, so they find different ways, and they are assisted by lawyers and different accountants that actually, and who at the same time, when we declare a process of amnesty, then they turn around to assist them to regularize. So they make the money, they make the money to for these people to take it out, and they make the money for these people to register. So they score on both sides. And somebody, I think earlier this morning, alluded to the fact that maybe they might be called so that we can understand their modus operandi. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, do you believe your questions have been responded to, comments, because there's one more to come? Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. Just to add on the issue of glitches on our system, we want to assure the House that there's no glitches with regards to our illicit financial economy. There's no glitches whatsoever. So you can be rest assured that on that aspect, we are doing our best. Thank you.
Sorry, Chair. We just wanted from the FRC side to respond to the question about digital economies. So the FRC, following the international standards in terms of the compliance framework around money laundering, terror financing, dealing with virtual assets, and we're currently in the process of getting the virtual currency exchanges as part of the compliance framework, similar to the banks. So they would need to report information to us, and they would need to request certain documents when they act in, or when they become in a relationship with a person that wants to deal with virtual currencies. We've also built some capacity around looking at the blockchain in terms of tracking and tracing transactions around virtual currencies, and we've worked on some cases in this regard as well, where neighboring countries transferred the proceeds of crime into South Africa, and we were able to track these currencies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Lees, I think, all right, fine, thank you. Members, I know there are many more questions we would like to engage on, but time is against us in every sense of the word on today, but as well as the term of Parliament itself. The one thing simply to remember, as we know about the tax issue, it does erode transformation as well. Thank you. Can we then ask and call on DDG Mamoniat, National Treasury to share with us his presentation from National Treasury. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. There's not much more we can say, but let me be quick, Chair, and just go through. Do you want to just get the slide going? Yeah. Chair, I think, let me just provide a broad context. I think that, as we've seen, there's been real progress that's been made. And largely that's because the political climate has changed. And there's total commitment in government now to deal with illicit financial flows, and especially the illegal. We can now, and I'm really looking at what's the difference between what we're saying today and what we said in 2017 when we last appeared. We can now talk openly about state capture, which was difficult to do before 2018. And I'll be more specific, between a certain date in February 2018. Okay. Before that, I think even many MPs refused to talk about it. We certainly were talking about it, but you got your head chopped off if you dared to talk about it. I think we know that we've got three important commissions which are beginning to provide a lot of light on this matter. You've had the Zondo Commission. You've had the very, very efficient SARS Commission. And, of course, you've got the PIC Commission going on under Judge Mpati. We've only got so far the final report from Judge Nugent. And there was a presentation to the Senate Committee on Finance. And really, if members have not gone through it, it's really important that it be read. And especially from our colleagues from Hawks and NPA, I hope you're reading it. And I say so because, you know, when you had the last head of the NPA, I saw him 3 months after Tuli Madonsela had reported on state capture. This was in February after the budget, and I went to Fatah and I asked him, have you read her report? And I was shocked, although not that shocked to be honest, that he told me he hadn't read it. Okay, so there was no curiosity about reading that report. So I hope the climate has changed, the mindset has changed, and that people at least read the reports that are out there in the public domain. And so I think we're happy that, you know, the changes in the leadership at the Hawks and NPA does make us more hopeful. Let me say quite bluntly, we had no faith. We knew the Hawks and the NPA, before the changes in their leadership, would do sweet nothing. And they did sweet nothing. If anything, they covered up. Not if anything, they did cover up for the wrong people. So it wasn't just the focus that was wrong. It was that they themselves were doing the wrong things. I think that since then, you've got a credible acting commissioner who, as the minister announced in the budget, is, you know, restoring the large business unit, the illicit trade units. And I think these are important points because dismantling those were clearly deliberate and actually facilitated more illicit flows. It was to make sure that the illicit flows were not caught that these things were dismantled. And it's good to see that the acting commissioner has taken steps and is moving to restore these units. Because, and I think that's the point, we can talk about transfer pricing, BAPS, etc. We've made changes to the law. But if SARS wasn't geared up, if the LBC wasn't geared up, there's nothing much we can do. And I think that when you deal with illicit flows, it's quite important that every authority that has whatever powers does what it's supposed to do. So only SARS can look at the tax affairs of anybody. We can all talk in theory about transfer pricing. We can have the best laws on paper. But if SARS didn't have the capacity or the will to actually do something about it, there was, again, sweet nothing that could have been done by any of us. So I certainly have confidence that SARS has been, the process to restore it to where it was is now on track. And I think the FIC and SARB, not that they were ever destabilized, but they continue under good and stable leadership. The director was very modest. I don't know if she's ever come to Parliament, but she replaced Mr. Marie Michel, whose term came to an end.
She has been here before.
Oh, okay.
Very cooperative. Just to add everything,
I phoned her once at the last minute. She turned up, and the quality of her inputs are very good, so we're very impressed. Can I speak on behalf of the Standing Committee of Finance, at least the sensible people in the committee? I don't know if we can count Alf into it. And Gwen is too new to the committee to make any assessments. But, you know, and Mr. Kachalia is not a member of our committee, fortunately.
So, Chair, I was just saying that, well, I'm good that she has, because I couldn't remember if she's really come before the committee. So just to move on, I think that's not, so I think we are definitely have a much more optimistic feel about what's happening. Let me say that the other big thing is that the agencies, as you've seen, are all working together. When we came in 2017, the agencies were not working together. Or to the extent it was there, you could give the Hawks and NPA reports, but the reports were going nowhere. Now at least it appears, I mean, we don't have sight of it as a department, but it appears as a to and fro they're engaging, because if the info is given, presumably those who receive it have further questions and so on. So I think that is important. I think the FIC did point out on some of the structures. They're not all there yet. He said it was more certainty, but they are developing those structures. The chart that he had, to get down to work. I think, Chair, some of the challenges, and we all agree, the data are still all over the place, and that's because obviously people don't report on such activities. But I do want to warn, there are lots of sensational numbers around. And to be honest, and I'm raising this because they're actually not helpful. There are many institutions whose job is to get into the news and have big numbers. It doesn't help. I think that all these numbers, we don't have a problem, that they need to be interrogated. One needs to know the source. One needs to see how reliable they are. Because to the extent that we get more reliable numbers, we can actually then act and we can see where the problem is. So that's still a big challenge that we have to sort out. It's not an easy problem. And I think that despite the cases that have proceeded, I still don't see big names. The Chinese say, I think, the tigers and the flies. So we're getting all the flies, but I'm waiting for a few tigers, to be caught. And I think that, so I would still want to appeal to the prosecuting authorities. I think it would be great for the morale of the country if they actually do act on the big cases. So a lot of illicit flows, yes, everybody plays at it. You've got multinationals play on transfer pricing and whatever those amounts are, that's one issue. But certainly state-owned entities within government, it's a shame, it's a disgrace. But people were embarking on these activities. Monies were going through Dubai, Hong Kong, and whether you look at the Transnet trains, the Danel, VR Laser, these things are coming out at the Zondo Commission. Eskom and the deal that they wanted that the last acting CEO sign, Sean Maritz, I think. Prasa, there's issues, there's Homix. There's a lot of cases, and honestly, as a layperson, I'm not sure what more evidence is really needed in many instances. I think we've talked about illegal tobacco. At least it's good to see SARS has started to grow its teeth again, that there's been raids now, and I think that's positive. And Chair, when I say that there's more prosecution cases, I mean, let me just abuse this opportunity and tell you about VBS. There may not be illicit flows, although inevitably people who loot money, even if you're not aware of it, they like to get the money out into another jurisdiction because it's damn difficult. If you send it to Dubai, it's almost impossible, I think, to get the money back. Okay, something that we need to take up internationally through FATF and so on, because they are soft on certain jurisdictions. Even the list that I saw the EU wanted to publish didn't have the ones that really affect us. So those are areas we need to look at. But I can tell you on VBS,
right,
we've given many forensic reports, even per municipality. We've done 10 out of 20. We're doing, you know, so beyond the reports that you've seen, and you've just seen the overall summary, those forensic investigators are busy at work compiling municipality by municipality what evidence they've dug up through the sworn statements.
Right. I think, though, DDG, we need to just focus. We really only have 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'll finish in a minute. So I'm saying a lot of those have been given to the Hawks and the NPA. So I think we would still like to see real progress there. I think just to end off, we certainly are in the process of fixing up SARS and its customs and excise. And I think it's important there's no disruption from initiatives like the Border Management Authority. That bill has lapsed, but we do need to continue with these processes. Chair, we're running short of time. I think, you know, I've talked about implementing the spirit and letter of the FIC Amendment Act. We can still improve on a sharing of information. I think we've given you some figures on the voluntary I think Elijah has given it on the what's it? Voluntary? Yeah, the disclosure program. Voluntary disclosure program. We don't call it an amnesty. That's why I don't want to use the wrong word, okay? And we've published these figures in a budget review on page 129 this year. And yeah, the other slides are just for info. They were old slides from the past. So I'll stop there. So we are very positive what's happening. And I think we just need more of this and strengthening, I think, of the initiatives that are taking place. Because I think the commitment is there now to deal with these issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DDG. That was Finance, the National Treasury. We can go straight on to DTI, but I think it would be worthwhile just to engage briefly to close off this side of things. Any comments or questions for National Treasury? Yes, Honourable.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for walking in late, but my apology was already ahead. Chair, I just wanted to agree with Momo about the Nugget Commission, and I think it's one of the commissions that, in spite of all the problems that the country is going through, at least it makes you have hope that we are in the right direction. And I know that he has spoken broadly to the recommendations and what is being done. And I just wanted to check whether they still have their hand on the pulse and they are certain, therefore, that the recommendations that are very good that were made there are being implemented in totality. Thanks, Chair.
Very much. Yeah. Yes, Honourable Nguyen.
Just two questions. The first is, do we do any kind of international comparisons about, and I know this area is difficult again, so all my questions have been kind of data related, and I know there's difficulty in obviously being able to track performance and that kind of, you know, subject in this area, but is there any kind of international comparisons that we can look to as to what our performance should be and how we're doing? And the second question was around cost efficiencies. Again, I think obviously there's a principled reason for pursuing any kind of illegal activity, so I'm not quite sure you would view pursuing of any legal activity from a financial point of view, but I'm just curious as to what is the relative cost that we spend pursuing these type of activities relative to the amount of money that is recovered.
Thank you very much. Honourable Lise, did you want to write? I just wanted to say how much it is appreciated that I don't have the number, but on the slide that says what are illicit flows and how do we get better data, some very pertinent questions. If only we could get that information. And one would hope in the sixth parliament, co-chair, that is pursued, because this is precisely why we can't get a handle, an effective handle on illicit flows. But thank you for the work you are doing. Yourself, co-chair.
Firstly, I think for Momo to acknowledge progress in this area, I think is the most important thing, because I know he's been really frustrated, right, in private exchanges. So I think the biggest compliment you've got is not from the Standing Committee on Finance chair or members, who you sometimes may think are too tough on you, but we do it in the interest of the country and in your own interests and our interests, really. So firstly, for Momo to say, well, you can see some progress, is, I think, quite illuminating and revealing. Secondly, you know, I know Momo raises this every now and then, that, you know, the figures can be inflated and exaggerated. I know there's a stream of thinking both in SARS and National Treasury that says that the figures are inflated, but I think Momo will agree that even if the figures are half what people say, it's bad enough, right? And you, you know, you're the tax man, so to speak, in National Treasury. So this is your forte. This is what you want done. But I'm glad that you're saying it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got a day-to-day feel for these issues. We partly go by our intuition and instinct and what we can tell from what people are saying, but, you know, it's words that are uttered here. But I entirely agree with you. My own view is that, yes, there's been marginal progress. It's welcome. It's much better, as Peggy said, was it the Galady, than yesterday, listening to you on Steinhoff, Hawks and the NPA. But it's nowhere near where we should be. As he rightly says, you know, one or two big people, you know, that will be the real test. And we'd like to see it happen within the next year. You know, one or two big companies. Once you do that, it will signal to others. They'll get more sophisticated in what they do. But I agree broadly with what Momo was saying in his observations of where things are. That's all I wanted to say. The second thing is I want to plead also that you understand that we understand the difficulties you've got, NPA, Hawks, FIC and so on. We understand. You know, if we were in your position, it's not as if we're going to be able to do much better with the limited resources we have. But all of us have to work together to just get this thing nailed down, like never before, given our financial stresses. Okay, done. Thank you for my side.
I don't want to use the word that concludes it, because it doesn't. It's still open. But is it Mandla who wanted to speak at that point? Because, or did you say Amandla? Maybe that's what you said, yeah. Yes, that's right. DTI, please. Is it Mr. Rabulana?
Yes. In fact, I'm Mr. Desmond Ramabulana from the Department of Trade and Industry. So I come from the, I'm Director of Commercial Law and Policy within the Department of Industry. So before I go on, I just want to indicate that we are not an enforcement unit, we are not a regulator. So we're just a policy unit within a department. So we don't do any investigation, and we also don't have any statistics in as far as investigations or specific cases are concerned. And that normally issues around tax issues like illicit financial flows, profit shifting are not actually within our mandate. So, but we are going to indicate as to how do we link with as far as coordination is concerned with other finance departments and regulators who are here. So, in fact, the DTI, we are the custodians of the Companies Act, in which we also administer the Financial Reporting Standard Council, which administers financial reporting in terms of the Companies Act. So, in fact, I only have a three-slide presentation, so I'll just go, I'll move over, so I won't go through the first slide. So I'll go to the second slide where Rene were just indicating that we are in the process of amending the Companies Act. And during this process, some of the areas that we're trying to tighten is that areas around filing of annual returns, wherein we are going to amend our act in order to make sure that companies also maintain in their securities registers, they must always maintain records of beneficial holders of securities. And we are also making sure that at least companies also disclose when, despite keeping them in their records, they must also disclose all their they must also disclose beneficial owners of securities also when filing annual returns. So these are the type of things that we are doing in order to align with the international standards that are now forthcoming. So what we are currently doing is that, in fact, the bill was before cabinet in October, and now it went out for public comments, and public comments closed in December 2018. So we are busy reviewing all the comments around around the bill, and we are targeting quarter two of 2019 as the time to introduce the bill to Parliament. So we are also of the belief that illicit financial flows cut across various regulators in the DTI, and we will collaborate with and have and also commit to all various coordination efforts to address all the serious challenges caused by these illicit financial flows. So as I'm just indicating, like I said, that we are not we do admit that normally in this committee, is not about statements of generalizations or policy issues or conceptualization issues. It's all about action as to what has to go on. But as we're indicating, we are part of the interdepartmental coordination. We are attending all meetings with the, especially with the regulators of the financial, sector. We do attend meetings with national treasuries, treasury. We are in all meetings wherein we are trying to help and do all the interdepartmental coordination. So the way we relate with the coordination in these instances is that we also relate through DTI and the CIPC legislation and policy relationship. So what is happening is that CIPC is the custodian of registers through which all agencies and regulators, when investigating their cases, they have to see that information is readily available in those registers. So, in as far as our experience is concerned, and in all the coordination meetings that we are attending with National Treasury, we have not yet come across any challenges in as far as regulators come across when accessing CIPC registers when investigating cases. It's just that in the cases that are being investigated, maybe CIPC themselves are the ones who can be in a position to can share as to which cases involved maybe companies which are in their register. But this will depend on what level in which the regulators who are investigating share with them. But in just a nutshell, we are coordinating, we are attending all the meetings, and we don't have any challenges at the moment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rabulana. Are there any comments, questions? No? I think... yes, Honorable.
Thanks, just a small one for me. I don't know, when the director talks about everything that they are not, they make you suspicious that they don't want to answer to some of the issues that they are accountable for, because he told us everything that they do not do. However, for me, I don't know, maybe I need clarity as to if they are custodians of the company policy. Therefore, how are they not custodians of the implementation thereof, and how are they not custodians or competent to, how then does the Act perform, where are the loopholes, and if you're going to be dealing with amending the Act, how do you go about doing it if you don't know how it performs? So I'm just saying, Chair, though I think he said he has nothing to do with it, I don't know whether he is in a position to tell me what I want to know. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair?
Yeah, I'm surprised you speak the way you do. Yeah. Because you've been here before, my brother, and you know that trade and industry is crucial to dealing with illicit financial flows. Invoice, Ms. pricing and so on falls, if I'm correct, yeah, under your portfolio, and the committee chair is right here, and from day one, you, the Trade and Industry Committee, jumped the gun, and in fact, there's nothing to hide. There were members of our committee, ANC comrades, who came to me and said, what are they doing with this issue? So I say, what does it matter if they're dealing with it? It's the same parliament. We've got thousands of pieces of legislation. Let them do it. So we used your public hearings that you organized, my friend, your committee, right? You all had the first public hearings on illicit financial flows, you recall. I mean, not that young. You'll recall 4 years ago with Minerals. And then when everybody came to us and said, can we have public hearings? We said, but we've just had a public hearings. And we took your report in finance and endorsed it, right? Your report, meaning your portfolio. So trade mispricing falls really strongly under your... As I know, it's also in other parliaments in the world. Trade of industry works together with finance committee. Moreover, here you are, in the Companies Act, you're making exactly what you should be doing. You're making an amendment to the Companies Act based on the bill that we passed, the FSRA, about beneficial owners. And I'm glad to see you bringing it to this parliament this very year. Very good. So you have a role to play. And you are working in the interdepartmental group. So I think, you're very much important, although you're obviously not going to report to us on statistics in the way that the Hawks and the NPA would know. You understand that. But you do have a very important role to play. So I'm interested to know what your response is to my observations. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I, too, was very surprised, considering we've had several hearings and colloquiums on this, and the relationship with the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act. Transfer pricing is directly related to the point why the unencumbered financing there doesn't work. And we had repeatedly asked for the companies to have their primary listing here, certain companies, and SIPSI attended all of those hearings. So I think that what is the nature of transfer pricing? What is the nature of industry and the economy? And if we can just, if all members of trade and industry can make themselves familiar with the BBBEE, as well as industry and IPEP, then you will see only too well the nature and the damage that illicit flows does to us, the mispricing that goes on that companies are involved in. That is a very critical point. So I'm very pleased that you were able to come here. There'd be no reason for us to invite FIC to some of our meetings in trade and industry if we had nothing to do with it. So I think that there needs to be a clearer understanding of the relationship between trade and industry and finance. And I would certainly ask you to discuss this with your colleagues in trade and industry, including the commissioner, the advocate, Rory Foller, and ask him about the importance that this plays. But I do welcome the decision and the progress made on amending the Companies Act. I think that that will help. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, I would just like to answer that question about as to who is the custodian of the Companies Act. If we are the we are administrative the Act, how do we implement it? So normally we are the policy division, and the our implementers is the CIPC. So it's just that unfortunately the CIPC are not part of this program. So even some of the cases and some of the investigations that are being done by maybe by the agencies are done through CIPC. And also when I attend the coordination meetings, I do it especially on behalf of the relationship with CIPC, for through whom information about registers and all registers of directors should be obtained through them, but just that they are not part of this program. So that is what I can say on that one. On the other issue that was raised by the chairperson, I will what I recall was that before I started coming here, there was a division that was dealing with research, DTI division dealing with research. They did some of the research regarding around this illicit financial flows, but it's just that I don't know what happened to the research report. That is where they were. I think they are called ERPC. ERPC. I've just forgotten the abbreviation, but they are the ones who worked on the DTI side. When I joined, I found that they were no longer coming. They were no longer involved, because even they themselves were indicating that as they are no longer in enforcement, they are not an enforcement agency. As the committee has already gone through that stage of conceptualization, therefore they won't be able to contribute. They didn't see their role as to any as far as contribution is concerned. So that is where I also took over.
Yes. You're quite right. That's why we asked our minister to engage with the Minister of Finance to ensure that legislation was crafted. But our co-chair and the senior chair here would... This is finance, standing committee,
yeah,
and I'm joining you.
Yeah. You might want to say something too. Look, as it happens, we're ending this five-year term on a joint meeting. I had wanted to put a 10-minute meeting in for the Standing Committee on Finance, but then I thought, look, I'm sure you might have some words to say as well.
as outgoing chairs. So on behalf of, I mean, to the Standing Committee on Finance in particular, I want to thank very much all the members for their participation and cooperation over the last 5 years. I think at times it's been quite testy, tetchy, difficult, polarized, but perhaps, you know, it's related to the nature of the issues we deal with, but also the personalities that are here. And I think the two key personalities, well, I think they won't be here come the end of May. So hopefully the next committee will be better. Because I think, you know, on many finance issues, ultimately it's very political, ideological, and policy-related issues. But given where we are as a country, I think there's a greater need for this committee to cooperate more, perhaps, than, say, other committees. We really have a, you know, whatever our ideological and policy differences, whether we're in the far right or far left of this parliament, we do have a common national interest. As I said in the House the other day, if we don't have a national interest, then we don't have a country. Mm-hmm. Then there's nothing. And it's you know, it's, I reminded you, remember, was in the House or wherever, that there was this coach who had trained, I think, the Senegalese football team. And then he came to train Bafana, and he made a very instructive comment on TV. I was struck by his facial expression. He said, you know, I've never come across a country or a football team that you cannot bring together. It's like, you know, difficult to bring people together. And it struck me, you know, that when I saw this thing that Tito Mboweni convened, I don't know, Momo, you might have been, the Houseman said that there's not a strong enough sense of us to get economic growth, right? I think it's true. You need a minimal sense of us. We got it when Madiba passed away. We got it in the 2010 World Cup. Who will forget that wonderful goal that Tshabalala scored almost near the halfway line and how our hope soared? Who could forget that? All of us, from the AWB to the world, what was that? Does Wurza still exist, Neville Alexander's people? Right, the Trotskyites. Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, I would like to leave on this note that I would hope that the new incoming committee will work more cooperatively. To my comrades in the ANC, I hope we can get to meet this afternoon for a few minutes. I see them a lot, and I've worked, you know, I really think we, you know, I can only speak for myself as a chair of this study group. Tanya's not here, but both of us, we're very lucky to have, overall, the team we've got. And I want to wish everybody well. Those who are coming back, Tolo will be back, right? She's very high up, so she'll be back. Peggy is doing very well on the provincial list. She'll be gone, unfortunately. Unfortunately, nobody else is coming back. But, I wish those who are back the very best, but even more those who are not coming back. And it's not the end of the world. As I said yesterday, many of us in the ANC ranks, and maybe some of the other parties, I don't know enough, were activists long before we became public representatives, and we'll continue to be activists. I also regret that Comrade Joan will not be back, but she is first and foremost an activist and then a public representative. I have no doubt, to the last drop of her breath, she'll be politically active, as indeed will I. Once again, I want to thank everybody, and I wish all of you well. But perhaps you want to say something to your members. Well, there's only 1 year as it happens.
No, we did say our goodbye and farewells yesterday, but I do want to thank the Honourable Kichalia for availing himself of this meeting. I think having said farewell yesterday, some thought, well, yes, a farewell. But what I would like to put on record is the importance of having joint committee meetings. It's not just trade and industry and finance, but spreading that as we did to minerals, you know, and energy and that sort of thing. And I think that we must get away from the silo approach. We need to have permeable barriers where, yes, you work alone sometimes, but most of the time, to achieve any sense of unity, to achieve the country's goals, we've got to break down these silos. And we can only do that, and that's what I found remarkable about the presentations today, Eunice, and that is Chairperson. The entities here, for the first time that we've been having these joint committee meetings, it's 2 years or more, I've really sensed the you are collaborating, you're working together. This is the first time I've reached that. And consequently, as Mr. Mamoniat has himself observed, there is progress. And I would hope that the sixth parliament can build on this progress. We haven't cracked it yet, but we've identified, we've done the diagnosis, and that took us a long time. We do need now to address the situation. But I want to personally thank you, Honourable Karim. It's been a pleasure working with you in these meetings. Thank you.
Just one other practical thing. The staff, we've conveyed our gratitude to them in our exit report, in our last report on the fiscal framework. I will obviously meet with them next Wednesday or Thursday to say farewell to them on behalf of the committee as a whole. But I want to say also our staff in the Standing Committee on Finance has been very good. And I hope as many of them will stay. I hope somebody's listening. Somebody in particular, I'd like to pass a resolution if I could. I hope she will stay for another 2 years at least. And that all the staff will stay on. And finally, I think in our exit report, there is one more thing we can slide in, Zakhele, that the chairperson, mention him by name, the chairperson of Mineral Resources, Mr. Zed Luzipo, should know there is a difference between the 20th of February and the 20th of March. Three exclamation marks thereafter. And then we can add, you know, you guys, do what you'll take photographs of these things.
Yeah.
Add this thing, and it shows here, Zakhele, 20th of March. You had a huge fight with me about who's older and whose memory lapses are greater. I said, true, mine are. You're half my age. You're going to call me Baba. Okay, I made a mistake, and guess what? When I look at it, no, I'm right and he's wrong. Put that in our exit report. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, despite your apparent deliberate exclusion of saying a single word about the DA,
the two people that were adversarial, one is DA and one is ANC, and both are not coming back, so that's a relief, right? The one I'm obviously referring to from the ANC is not me, it's Tandy, right? So as long as we know. No, I meant
Mr. Chairman, let me finish then, it was slightly misunderstood, but I thought it was perhaps your sense of humour again, and I've got have a very similar sense of humour, and perhaps that's why from time to time we've had our downs, but I think most of the time we've had our ups, and so I would... No, I always get sentimental, I'll be in tears just now. I would really like to thank you for the time that you've chaired our meeting. You've been professional. You have been nasty from time to time, but it's really actually has been a pleasure in a professional sense and in a personal sense being on this committee with you. But then let me say about the other members of the committee. There are no other members of the committee that we've had really down times, I don't think, and if they have, they've been minor issues. So it's really been a pleasure. But at the end, I want to echo your sentiments about the professional staff who have served this committee with amazing professionalism and support. It really has been a pleasure. I'm not going to say that this is better than anything I've experienced, because I really do think that my experience in the select committees and the NCOP was excellent as well. So I've been blessed with working with fantastic professional staff, and a very big thank you to them as well.
Kind words, and just to make it clear, everybody, including the EFF who came, despite all the problems we had, we thank everybody for their participation. Thank you very much.